Hi, this is Rick Emerson, and the following encore of The Rick Emerson Show is brought to you by Squires Electric. Whether it's electrical wiring, Ethernet wiring, or wiring of any kind at all in your home or business, Squires Electric can make your life easier. Find out more at squireselectric.com or call 503-252-1609. Squires Electric.
Thundar, the Barbarian.
The year 1994. From out of space comes a runaway planet, hurtling between the Earth and the Moon, unleashing cosmic destruction. Man's civilization is cast in ruin. 2,000 years later, Earth is reborn. A strange new world rises from the old. A world of savagery, super science, and sorcery. But one man bursts his bonds to fight for justice. With his companions, Ookla the Mock and Princess Ariel, he pits his strength, his courage, and his fabulous sun sword against the forces of evil. He is Thundar, the Barbarian.
Hey, look! A Dungeons and Dragons ride!
Break.
I don't like this.
Whoa!
What's happening?
Whoa!
Where are we? Look out!
Fear not, stranger. Barbarian, magician, thief, cavalier, and acrobat. Avenger, the force of evil. I am Dungeon Master, your guide in the realm of Dungeons and Dragons.
Hello, it is 29 minutes after the hour of 1, and this the month of January, the year of our Lord, 2011. Thank you for coming by, making a part of your listening day. We are live from the plushly appointed yet not overly ostentatious studios of the Emerson News Network, high above the Milkpacking District, in glorious southeast Portland, Oregon, the home of all good things. Thank you for joining us. It's the Rick Emerson radio program, and unsurprising, I would imagine, to everybody, I just had those sitting around. I didn't even have to go looking for them.
Shocking.
All I had to do was put them back to back. Thundar, the bot, with his fabulous sun sword. The hell is that?
Oh, you know what that is.
And what is? And here's something you pointed out just now when that was playing. I've never noticed this like in the 50 billion times I've heard that opening and watched that show. The hell is super science?
That's science, only better.
It's hella science.
Hella science.
It's science to the max.
Extreme science.
All right, and whatnot. All right. This guy says, hey, what is that samurai music you play every day before the show? It makes me want to go pillage an S. Okay. The samurai music, I believe he's referring to the Godfather 2 theme that we play.
Oh, yes, because that sounds like samurai music.
Yeah, it just says, makes me want to go pillage and crap. What is the samurai music you play every day? That is the... That is by Nino Rota. That is Marcia Religioso is the name of that. That is from Godfather 2. That's from the sequence in Godfather 2. I shouldn't be snarky about it. It's not like I can just expect everybody to know that. That is from Godfather 2. It's the sequence when Vito Corleone is killing the Black Hand during the... And I don't even know what the festival is. I mean, it's like a... I don't think it's a Catholic thing as such. I think it's an Italian... It's an Italian festival of some kind, but I can't remember offhand if they ever even identify what it is. But, when the local mobster in New York is killed by Robert De Niro as Vito Corleone, that is the music that is playing. So, there you go.
Duh.
Seriously, where's your super science now, Dick? It is the Rick Emerson Radio Program. Thank you for joining us. It's Thursday, in case you couldn't tell. It's 503-505-6964, 503-505-6964. If you want to weigh in with your comments, questions, clarifications, observations, ruminations, ponderings, musings of an ironic nature, or notes about pillagings and samurai.
And fetishes.
Or fetishes, too. 503-505-6964. By the way, that is specifically why we use that music right at the beginning of the show, because it's, you'll notice that in the musical interlude, so Legion of News comes to an end at around 1, and then the show usually starts around 1:25-ish, you know, give or take, and we have, you know, like 15, 20 minutes of music that plays, and it's, you know, I don't know, we have like 200 songs or something, and I sort of rotate through them. But that is always the final thing we play, and you know what it is? That is sort of the auditory light flickering, like they do at the theater, when it's like, you know, the second half is about to be, intermission is about over, click, 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 and they turn it off and on. That is what that is. So it's like I'm trying to, so it's a sort of Pavlovian thing, that if you are listening live and you hear the music by Nino Rota, whose daughter's name? Nina Rota. You know that the program is about to get underway. So you have to, gather ye rosebuds and get ready. Okay, it's 503-505-6964 if you'd like to engage with us telephonically. You can also email if you like. It's rick@rickemerson.com. rick@rickemerson.com. Dawn Taylor, pardon me. Dawn Taylor can be reached at dawn@rickemerson.com. That is D-A-W-N at rickemerson.com. You can also text us via the text box at the website, and you can Skype us. That is Rick Emerson Show.
Skype us.
That is Rick Emerson Show is how you can contact us via Skype. So thank you for drawing near that ye might be amused and informed on this Thursday. Coming up today, we got your Corpse Watch. Now, here's the thing about today's Corpse Watch is that I don't know what it is. You know what it is. Sarah and Greg know what it is. The audience may or may not. Because we were sitting here preparing to do the show, and it's, of course, you know, Sarah Dillon and Greg Nibbler, we split the studio with them, and sometimes they tape after us in the afternoon, but occasionally they are before us in the morning. So we came in today. They had already done their show. They were sitting in the kitchen, and I was sort of here with you, and we were getting ready for things. And then Sarah just shouted in from the kitchen. She just goes, "Hey, do you have that Corpse Watch?" And then I said, "Which one?" And Sarah just said a few things out loud, a few key words, and you immediately weighed in and said, no, I've already got that. That I do indeed. It's set aside. But I didn't really hear what she said, and so I don't really know what the Corpse Watch is about, but I know that you guys shared a little secret smile and a chuckle amongst yourselves.
Yeah, it's one of those, of course I have that story. Yeah. Oh, indeed.
Is it one of those things, I didn't get a chance to really check my email this morning, is it one of those things that was probably sent to us by 500 people?
A couple of people did send it to me, and it's one of those things where I had already spotted it. I had espied it, what with my whole Google alert for the word corpse.
Well done. So. Excellent. So we got your Corpse Watch coming up today. Also, a snuff watch. Is today's snuff watch, is it really yesterday's
snuff watch?
Okay, yeah. So we didn't really get a chance to get to that. Because it's not like it's really time sensitive. Like he's
going
to get up and, dancing a jig
anywhere.
Or something. So we'll get to that. So we got your snuff watch coming up today. Also, your top five. So yesterday you did the top five songs about drinking in honor of the 92nd anniversary of the passing of Prohibition, which was this week in 1919. And so you had eschewed country. Now, is that because it was just too overwhelming? There was just too many to choose from?
Pretty much, yeah. It was just kind of... I mean, also, yeah, it's where do you
stop?
Do you pick?
Yeah,
really?
I mean, it becomes really just the tyranny of choice, as my wife would say. So I have... Now, I'm not saying that my list is definitive, so I have left country in other words, I'm selecting from the country genre as well, but I did try to make it so it was not purely country, because you have to have some sort of sense of balance, or otherwise, yeah, it's just going to be nothing but like Hank Williams songs or something. So I have put together, in my opinion, here's the other thing that I thought about doing the top five country songs. I was unclear about whether I should trend towards. If I should have some sort of a rule for tone, because a lot of times songs about drinking can be kind of downers, you know, but occasionally they can be celebratory, or they can be a little bit of both. They can be songs about things that are, you know, the morose subject matter, but in a very energetic way. And I finally decided I wasn't gonna put any further filters on it. So I've just got what I believe to be. This is my, and I will also not claim to be speaking for anybody else. I think this is just for me. is the top five songs about drinking in the opinion of me, Rick Emerson. So we'll do that later
With the exception of my number one from yesterday, which would have been on your list, but you
that
didn't want
true.
To duplicate.
I had to, no, and I did leave. That's true. I'm glad you pointed that out. I left Frank Sinatra's One for My Baby off the list because that was the one yesterday that I told you. I'm like, you got to have this on or I'm just going to disown you. I will pretend that I will be like Judas Iscariot and pretend that you are unknown to me.
But you didn't tell me ahead of time what song it was that you would hold against me
right.
if I didn't have.
Well, I didn't want to because I wanted to wait and see if it appeared. And sure enough, it did.
And there was.
So anyway, so we'll get to that later on. We've also got another installment of the greatest songs ever made. That'll be sometime between, I don't know, now and 2 p.m. Or so. Also, and we will get to this kind of up top here because we were going to do it yesterday with Aaron Mesh. Yesterday was a day where I think everybody was a little bonkers.
Wow. Yeah, yesterday was a crazy show.
I mean, it wasn't bad. It was just sort of everybody was a little, everybody was, the Autopia ride in everybody's head, the tracks had shifted ever so slightly,
I think. Well, yeah, you and I both had crazy brain for completely different reasons. And then Aaron came in and he had no choice but to just sort of be just sort of doggy paddle along with it.
He had to turn into the skid, as they say. So well, we didn't get to this. This internet etiquette question, which sounds, and it is timely, and I guess not at the same moment for reasons that will be clear when I read it. So we'll get to that here in a second. Don Taylor is tracking the following stories for you on this Thursday.
The world's car makers are optimistic about an economic turnaround. Chat Roulette is staying in business thanks to 50,000 naked men. And Brett Favre's sister is arrested in a meth sting.
You know, whenever you talk about Brett Favre, now it's like Matt Damon. I just want to go, Brett Favre. In the background for no reason. I don't know why. Brett Favre's sister?
Yes.
Okay. And Chet Roulette, you say?
Chet Roulette.
All right. For once, and I'm not being ironic about this, because I don't mean this in an Eddie Haskell kind of way. I am very much looking forward to the news today. Because here's the thing. Somebody, we've already gotten a lot of questions, people asking if I slept last night. I did, sort of. Because, you know, yesterday, by the time I got home, well, so I got up at around, let's see, today is Thursday, yesterday was Wednesday, so I guess it was Tuesday morning, I got up at around 8. So I got up at around 8 a.m. So we figured out that I think by the time we started yesterday's show, I've been awake for 31 hours. By the time I went to bed last night, which is around 10 p.m., so that would be 48, so 38 hours. So I was awake for about 30, because, you know, it's like you reach a point where you just sort of, it's like I'm not trying to be like a, you know, Rick Emerson's not a hero, but it's just easier to stay awake, you know?
Yeah. Well, also, it throws you completely off, because I'll do that where I'll be really, really tired, and I look at the clock, and I realize, if I go to bed now, I will wake up at 2 a.m.
That's my thing, and it screws you up, right?
Yeah.
Because it doesn't matter how, with the exception of that weird thing around the turn of the year when I slept, like, all day, it doesn't matter how tired I am. It's like my body will only really tolerate me sleeping for so long. And so Laura was trying to get me to go to bed at, like, 8 p.m., because that's when. Here's the thing about my wife. One of the reasons I think we get along so well is because, as I've said, that we are similar, but we're not exactly the same. And so it is with our sleeping schedules, because she is really early to bed, early to rise. And, you know, like, she goes to bed at, like, 9 o'clock, largely because she gets up at 5 a.m. for work. But she goes to bed at 9, and she's like, you know, you ought to just come to bed at the same time, and that way, you'll be refreshed and revitalized when you wake up. And I was like, you know, if I go to bed at 9, I'm going to wake up at 2:30. And then I'm just going to be screwed in an entirely different way all over again, and this is not going to do anybody good. So she went to bed. I went and I was getting some, and I can tell sometimes when I have gone to sleep or when I have fallen asleep, if it happens unexpectedly, because I will check like the timestamp on an email that I was in the process of composing. But around 11 o'clock last night, I just fell asleep in the chair in my office, which actually doesn't happen very often. Because then it's like you just get shades of like your dad or Dagwood Bumstead or something. So I try not to be a guy who just falls asleep in furniture in the middle of the house. Because then you just feel like some Jagoff sitcom father. But I fell asleep in the chair in my office last night, and I woke up at, I don't know, like 2:30 in the morning or something. And Philo had been out in the house with me. And you've seen, you know, we all know the weird photograph of him that's on the website where he's just got that strange, like, Falcor look on his head. And so I woke up at like 2:30 in the morning, and he was just sitting in my lap staring at me with that look on his face. I don't understand why you're not moving. And so I just kind of dragged myself off to the bedroom and then woke up today. And it was, you know, and when I woke up today, I did have... I did have some of that sluggishness where it just took me a long time to sort of get myself out of sleep mode and into wakefulness mode. As a result, I've had very little chance to survey the news, to answer emails. I haven't done anything. So I'm really running behind in terms of the actual preparation for the show. So these stories, they're all going to be brand new to me as well as the people.
Ooh.
What did you do last night, Don Taylor?
Almost nothing, really. I like you said, I haven't been sleeping well lately, so it was kind of like I went home and I sat around and poked at the computer for a while and did some work. And then, like, we're at 8:30. I looked at Patrick and I went, like we've talked about, where you look at your spouse and you go, am I pathetic if I go to bed now? And he's like, no. And I'm like, ugh. So then I sat there for like another half an hour and he's like, I thought you were going to go to bed. I'm like, no, it was too early.
You were waiting it out, though. That's the thing.
You're
running out the clock.
Because pretty much.
You can't go to bed before like 9 or you're lame.
And also if I go to bed before 9, I like wake up at like 4 a.m. And it's kind of like, well, now what do I do? Because I don't want to get up at 4 o'clock in the morning. That's insane.
Right.
So, yeah. So I basically just sort of dragged it
was
out.
Was it last night his
could.
Dungeons and Dragons night or whatever?
No, that's tonight.
Oh, that's tonight. Okay.
Thursdays are his geeky gamer boy night. So
hey, what is a cavalier?
Weren't they sort of like knights who were guards of some sort?
I guess. I realize I don't really know. It's like I don't really know what a Valkyrie is.
I have this image. I hear the word cavalier and I imagine a guy in a metal helmet with a big feather sticking out of the top of it.
So he's like a medieval pimp?
Yes.
Wouldst thou care for the company of a lady?
Why, yes, good cavalier. A saucy wench would hit the spot right now.
How much dost thou proffer for around the world? Could I interest thou in a half and half?
I'm sorry. I was just listening to that Dungeons & Dragons opening right now where it's like the Thunder the Barbarian thing. And then the best part about the Dungeons & Dragons opening, by the way, is the little flair, the little trill that the Dungeon Master has to put everything when he goes, and acrobat. And but he says, but he's transforming the kids one by one into their D&D characters. And he says, you know, like magician, thief, acrobat, cavalier. And I don't know what a cavalier is. It's just that guy that looks like it's that guy that looks like Reggie from the Archie comics. He gets turned into the Cavalier, and I have no idea what that really what...
Yeah, I always imagine them as some sort of knight of some sort, only
like squire?
Only kind of fancy. Like kind of like stuck on themselves.
All right.
I'm a cavalier.
It, not unlike in the Gauntlet game, when in the Gauntlet game there's the wizard, there's the barbarian, and I believe the Valkyrie. And I don't really know what a Valkyrie is.
Oh, Valkyrie is a woman warrior. They were the big, kind of like an Amazon, only like more Germanic. They're the big honkin' female warrior.
Hey, let me ask you this: did you ever watch the Dungeons and Dragons cartoon?
No, okay. I did not.
Well, never mind then. I was going to ask you something, but here's the thing: I know that people can insert a joke here, but you would just be making up the answer. You would just be bluffing because there's no.
I would not.
Do you know the premise of the D&D cartoon?
No, I really don't. No, I mean, I know the game. I know some, you know, some stuff about the game, but I don't really know anything about the cartoon.
The cartoon is sort of, and I realize that it's maybe, I realize it's probably a road to nowhere to be looking at the Dungeons & Dragons cartoon and trying to extrapolate anything real about the Dungeons & Dragons world from it. But there's two things I've never understood about the Dungeons & Dragons cartoon. The premise basically is this. The upshot is that there's some kids, and they're in an amusement park in our world today. And the kids are at the amusement park, and they're riding a roller coaster ride, and it is called the Dungeons & Dragons ride. And that has no particular significance to them. It's just that it's sort of a medieval-themed roller coaster.
Yeah.
And the kids are on the medieval-themed roller coaster, which is also sort of a funhouse thing where it goes through, you know, and there's like a little, like an animatronic dragon that comes out and says, boo. And then something happens, and the roller coaster goes into a portal, and they end up in like the realm of Dungeons and Dragons. They end up like in an actual medieval wizards and witchcraft kind of world, where they are then transformed into these five different characters by the Dungeon Master, who has to.
So that is the premise they came up with to get these modern kids into this realm.
It's basically like a Connecticut Yankee in King Arthur's Court meets Land of the Lost meets, you know, whatever. So it's that. But the other thing is that the Dungeon Master, who basically is just you know, who basically is sort of like Bilbo Baggins as Yoda, the Dungeon Master has to recruit the kids to fight Venger, and Venger is the force of evil. He's the Sauron of the world.
And his name is Venger.
Venger.
But I think it's Venger.
Venger, V-E-N-G-E-R, I believe, as in vengeance.
Oh, okay.
Which is sort of a great name. But at one point, I realize I'm giving all this backstory to lead up to a question you can't possibly answer for like 50 different reasons. I should call Aaron about this. At one point, the Dungeon Master reveals that he created Venger. And I've never understood exactly what was up with that. They never give any further explanation, and I don't think that's a thing that's drawn from the game.
Well, because he's the Dungeon Master. Of course he created the bad guys.
Well, I guess. I mean, maybe that's the answer. I don't know. It's a thing that has sort of nagged at me low these many years. Not enough to actually, like, look it up or anything, but it's just one of those things that sort of... It's been the pee beneath my mental mattress.
Well, okay. I was looking for something on Facebook here because I had a mention when Patrick was in the hospital... his gaming group first started doing a new D&D campaign. And so, yeah, so I posted on Facebook December 8th that a friend of ours had visited Patrick in the hospital, and I wrote, it's updating Patrick on the characters his gaming group have created for their third edition D&D game. And I opined that this might be the first time the phrase halfling paladin with a war dog has been uttered in a hospital room.
Which makes it sort of fantastic. Incidentally, the Cavaliers apparently supported the English crown during the English Civil War.
Oh,
so they were a kind of knight style warrior. They were they engaged in Another guy is back who just types Z across the screen over and over and over again. Awesome.
I'm so glad he bothers to listen though and to text in to let us know that he's disapproving of our conversation.
That's awesome. All right, it is the Rick Emerson Radio Program. It's 503-505-6964, brought to you by EH Vending. That is ehvending.com. That's the website wherein you can find out more about them. If you are unhappy with the current provider of your vending machines or your vending service at your company or business, you can talk to EH Vending and they'll be able to cut you some sort of a deal. I mean, if you're unhappy with the people that are taking care of your business right now, why continue to give them your business, really, is the question. Contact Josh or James at EH Vending. You can find out more at ehvending.com. It is the Rick Emerson Radio Program. Before we get to the news, before we get to anything else, I'll say that we've got, again, top five coming up later on, Corpse Watch, Snuff Watch, and I got another installment of the greatest songs ever made. I have right here from Jeff an internet etiquette question, and I'm not going to say that I have the definitive answer to this, but I told him that I would get to it this week, so I don't want to let another sort of day go by. This just says, Rick, my friend Ryan asked me this, and I was hoping to hear your take on it. If a Facebook friend dies, do you unfriend them or what? I told him if it was a person you physically saw on a regular basis, no. You kept them in your friends list. However, if it was an e-friend only, you either unfriend them or you post to their wall regularly with odd, taunting, and often tasteless comments. Cheers, Jeff, a.k.a. Futzer. But I realized, because there's been a lot of discussion about this recently, because there was a woman in Britain who I think... I think she killed herself or something. She committed suicide or whatever, or maybe she had a terminal disease. But it was a thing where she herself posted some sort of like farewell cruel world message or whatever, and then she's dead. And the mom, her mom was having this whole battle with Facebook because Facebook, of course, they don't know if you're dead or not. I mean, it's like it's not, you know, they have no idea, because sometimes people just don't. Sometimes people have Facebook accounts and they don't ever post anything, and so there's no pattern of activity which can be demonstrably used to prove that you're dead. So as a result, it doesn't your account doesn't go into hibernation or suspension or whatever. So the mom was having a hell of a battle with Facebook trying to get the daughter's page turned off because her friends were posting, you know, tasteless messages. And so if you were to die, yeah, if you were just to keel over, it occurs to me, and it probably wouldn't occur to your friends either. I mean, if, like, you got a husband or a boyfriend or something, like, they might actually think to themselves, like, well, I should maybe get this. If they didn't know your password, they might actually take the time to contact Facebook. But if nobody thought to do it on your behalf, and, like, why would they, then your page would probably just stay up there. So then all your friends have got a creepy dead person appearing on their page all the time. So what would you do? Let's pick somebody who's not me. Let's say if...
Well, I will tell you, I had the experience that a friend of mine, when she got on Facebook and realized there were a whole bunch of us on Facebook that had known her best friend like 20 years ago, this girl we'd known who had died very unexpectedly of a brain aneurysm in the middle of having sex.
Oh.
And she was like...
Wait a minute, how do you know that part? Did she tell you that?
No, we all found out afterwards.
But I mean, how do you find out, though? Who told you?
We were all like, you know, 20 years old. Everybody tells everybody everything.
Well, oh, this didn't happen recently.
No, this happened like 20 years ago.
Oh,
this
okay.
is part of what makes it extra creepy.
Okay,
and so we were all these like dumbass kids, and this friend of ours died. And
so she was in your circle of friends when you were in your 20s. She died of brain aneurysm while having sex.
Right, and so this mutual friend of... She was the best friend of a woman, you know, I knew and I've known. She got on Facebook. We ended up friending each other on Facebook because, you know, we've known each other for a long time. And she decided that it would be a really cool idea to have a sort of a memorial to create a Facebook friend page for this dead friend. And the thing is, though, it wasn't like one of those things where she did a friends of or a memorial page or something like that. She actually created a Facebook page for her in her name.
It wasn't like a third party page, you know,
no.
The way it was put together. It was as though it were a personal page.
Yeah.
Okay.
And, you know, they'll call her, I don't know.
Sandra.
And then she would suggest that we friend it. So I would get these messages that would say
Sandra
things like,
Sandra would like to be your friend
yes.
on Facebook. Whoa.
Yeah, or it's like, you know, Julie suggests that you be friends with Sandra. And it's like, it was just too freaking creepy. And I was so glad when the suggestions to friend it finally stopped. Because it was like, no, she's dead. That's weird.
I like the idea, too, that you were being invited to something by Sandra, you know?
Yeah.
That's sort of like that.
Sandra wants to. Well, when I first got
Sandra would
thing,
like you to come visit her.
I didn't know that the friend had done this. And I got this thing that says, Sandra so-and-so would like to be friends with you on Facebook. And my first thought was like, wait a minute. I have not thought about this woman in a couple of decades.
Right.
And then I'm like, I thought she was dead.
Oh, that's just weird.
And then I started thinking about I was at her funeral. She is dead. What the hell? And then I found out what it was about, and then I was like, I don't want to have any part of this.
Did you accept the friend request?
No.
Okay, so you just did you?
I just ignored it. I just pretended I just wished it away to the cornfield and figured it would just go away.
But it's
eventually.
Probably still out there, right? I mean,
I'm sure it is.
Was there a profile picture?
Yes.
Was it? What was the profile picture?
It was her still alive, just, you know, a picture of her smiling and alive.
Can I just say this? Our friend Keelan weighs in and he says, I would have my parents take a picture of me in the casket and make it my profile photo.
Yeah.
And then he follows by saying, that sex must have been mind-blowing. At least I hope so.
Well, literally.
Well, I mean, really, I mean, if that's how you're going to go out, you got to figure that, I mean, it, you know, it's, I mean, I suppose yeah. One hopes that you would reach the moment of fulfillment at least.
I don't think I'm going, I already know ahead of time I'm not going to have a funeral with a body because I'm going to be cremated. But maybe I could get a picture taken of me now. Like looking like I'm dead, so that after I die, I could get Patrick to swap the picture out on my Facebook page.
Or just like a picture of you, like in a cemetery, like, you know, sort of like peeking out from behind a tombstone.
Just,
hey there.
Just standing all yeah. U2-like, looking all gloomy.
Or just like, you could just do this. You could just have a picture of you, like, at the keyboard, but like, you know, use some Photoshop setting so you're transparent, you know, so you're sort of just, you know.
Or just one of the same pictures I've always used, except now I have X's for eyes.
I was going to just say, or glowing eyes. That's awesome. I'm glad to know I'm not the only one who thinks about this.
If I had a friend who died on Facebook, I don't know if I would unfriend them. I might just so that if it was painful to me, I would unfriend them just so that I didn't see their name listed under
right.
friends. If it wasn't something that was painful to me, I would probably just, and if I didn't think it would hurt anybody's feelings or make anybody mad at me, I'd just unfriend it. And if people were posting stuff to the site, I would definitely unfriend it because I don't want to see that crap.
Yeah. No, it's like, we've had listeners, you know, who have passed away, and it's like, and I've made actually a point of not. I've not unfriended just because, I don't know, because do you get a notice if somebody unfriends you?
On Facebook, no.
Okay, so you don't see, because that's my whole thing is like, not to be all morbid about it, but I always just felt like if there was a listener who died and I unfriended them just, you know, for whatever, and again, you know, just for whatever reason, maybe again, just so it wouldn't come up and maybe weird other people out or something, I was always just thinking, well, God, if they have, if there's like a family member or friend who's sort of like dealing with all of their stuff in their absence, I don't want to see like, and Rick Emerson no longer wants to be your friend. Like, I just felt like somehow like I would, I mean, I guess it's a relative thing because they're already dead, but I felt like I would be piling on somehow. Like,
yeah.
Like
although there are.
Not only is he dead, Rick Emerson doesn't want to be his friend anymore.
There are these applications you can use that you can punch in your name and it will give you the stats and tell you who's added you and who's
really
who's dropped you. And I realized.
I don't want to know.
Yeah, as soon as I heard of that, I don't want to know.
I don't want to know that. No, that's
because if it's somebody that I actually know in real life and they dropped me off of Facebook, because honestly, that has happened. I have a specific story that I have never told about this friend who just like...
Is it somebody I know?
No.
Okay.
But it's like, you know, how if I ever have this conversation with her about why we're not friends anymore, the long list will include things like, well, you stopped reading my blog. You dropped me off of LiveJournal, which makes me think that A, either you don't want to know what I have to say, or B, you wanted to write things that you didn't want me to be able to read. Either way, that's an indication to me that we're not actually real life friends. So, you know, but yeah, but I realize on the Facebook thing, if it was someone I really actually knew in real life or something, like I think Seamus may have dropped me from Facebook again.
Well, the thing is that, Seamus, I think, has dropped. He deactivated his account again.
Oh, okay.
That's the thing.
Because I realized just the other day that
You really are just a neurotic ball of just... you are like the weirdest combination of just vanity and self-loathing. I mean... seriously, it's just the strangest confluence of, like, you know, love me, don't love me.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, no, I think, dear Dawn, I think that the deal with Seamus is... that Seamus had deactivated. Well, I think we discussed this, actually. But
I wasn't fretting over it. I just noticed a couple of days ago, I noticed, yeah, I haven't seen anything from Seamus on Facebook anymore.
Here's the thing. You weren't here. This is when Snyder was here. We were talking about, I don't know, maybe not last week, but it was a couple weeks ago when Eric Snyder was on the show. We were talking about Facebook and about Seamus specifically. He came up as an example. But I was talking about the time suck and about how Facebook just swallows time like nobody's business. I mean, it just takes like hours and hours and hours of your life, like every day. And I mentioned that Seamus had totally deactivated his Facebook account because he felt like it was just, he's just like, I have no time. It's like, I got all these email accounts, I got work, I'm doing, you know, he's on Xbox Live a lot, and that's got its own messaging system. So he turned it off.
He's got to put in like 10 hours a day on Call of Duty,
exactly.
And that eats up a lot of your time.
Freedom doesn't defend itself, Tom.
No.
But then he reactivated his Facebook account like for 1 or 2 days to pimp something in particular, and then he just deactivated the whole thing again. So I think it may have, like when he reactivated it, I think it may have just assumed, like it picked up all of his old friends, like, you know, he was just going to sort of resume where he left off. But then when he deactivated it, it dropped them all again. So I think that's what that's about. That's the thing I just prefer not to know. Like, I don't ever look into who... It's not like I don't care. I'm just saying, like, I try not to pay attention to how many friends I've got or to if it's more than I added last week or if, like, the number of friends that I'm adding seems to have slowed down. Because you can read so much crap into that may or may not even be true. It's like, it's just what... That to me is like guys who sit there... You know, it's like radio guys who sit there and they... Because now with radio, it has become like it is with TV, where literally you can look at overnight ratings. And it didn't used to be that way. In radio, it used to be that you would have the ratings come out about every 90 days. And about every 3 months, you'd sit and you'd be able to see who, you know, theoretically, who was listening and what kind of audience you had and what shows got the most, you know, the biggest audience. And then it was a thing where you could do it monthly. Then they started having these services that you could look at radio ratings every week. And by the time I left KUFO, literally you could sit there and you could look at every single hour of every day, you know, for the previous day. You had like overnights, basically, where you could look at every day for like Wednesday and see what hours of the program and what sections of the hour had the biggest number of listeners. And I actually just said, I'm like, don't show it to me. I'm like, I don't want to know. That you can just keep that. And I've always been that way. I was never obsessive about ratings because it's like, there's nothing I can do about it. So I prefer just to, I'm going to go on my merry way and just walk down an ignorant path of bliss. So, all right. So there you go. So and I would say for me, I would say it depends. I would say if it's a good friend, and if you think the friend would have wanted it this way, then I say you continue to keep them as a friend, and maybe post something that's maybe post something tasteless every now and again. Like if you suspect that, like, that's, you know, if they died as they lived, if they don't want to be remembered in death as they were loved in life.
Yeah, if we keep my Facebook thing activated, I'd hope that you would pop in every once in a while and just post something like, "Hey, Don, how you doing?
See, that was exactly
feeling
my
better."
Thing. Just every now and again, maybe log on as the friend and just send everybody, you know, just send everybody some sort of unnerving message. You know, it sure is cold here. And then just, you know, and then just log out again. All right. Well, in any event. Oh, or maybe this. Maybe if you, now we've taken this in a totally different direction. But if you've got a friend who has passed away on Facebook, and maybe if you somehow are able to administrate their account or their, you know, if you like, if you, if their family, you know, if, you know, it, you know, has their information, if you somehow are able to continue operating the account in their absence, what you would do then is you would actually then you would actually have them contact other friends making specific observations about things they had done recently in their life. You know? Hey, that's a nice blue dress you bought yesterday. And then just log off again. You know? Just do that maybe once every couple of months just to sort of keep people on edge.
You should really cut back on the caffeine.
Can I just say this one thing, though, about Facebook? And I wasn't going to admit this, but now you've talked about the girl having having aneurysm while dying during sex. By the way, so this was a woman. She had sex and was having sex with a man. Mm-hmm. Did you know the guy?
No, I'd never met the guy. Apparently, they had gotten engaged. I knew her. I knew her socially, but I wasn't really close to her.
Did you ever want to track the guy down and ask him, like, what's up with that?
He was at the funeral, and I just kept looking at him and just thinking, that all I could think is, that's going to screw up your future relationships. That's going to scar your sex life for a long time to come.
I would imagine you probably have difficulty really getting into the sex from that point on.
Because this was one of those things that happens that you'd see on, like, in TV
CSI,
movies and stuff.
Yeah,
that she was healthy, she was fine, everything was fine, they were having sex, and all of a sudden she just keeled over and was dead.
Can I reveal? No, I don't.
And that has got to be bad for future erections.
Yeah,
it really does.
Yeah, the ability to achieve and sustain, I would imagine, is going to be severely impacted.
Oh yeah.
I was going to say something. I probably shouldn't though. I was just going to reveal something, but it seems like it's probably a bad. It seems like it's going to get me into trouble.
Apparently, she was on top, so he knew right away.
Nope. All right.
Okay.
It is the Rick Emerson Radio Program. Thank you for joining us. 503-505-6964. 503-505-6964. At the news desk, it is Dawn Taylor.
And now, from the news desk, this is Dawn Taylor.
6 months after its launch, traffic at Chat Roulette has dropped by nearly 60%. And the site is being written off as a passing fad. So to keep things afloat, 18-year-old founder Audrey Turnovsky has figured out how to profit off of Chat Roulette's most notorious feature, naked dudes. With exhibitionists making up roughly 10% of Chat Roulette's daily users, Turnovsky has decided to turn them from a problem into a resource, setting up deals with adult sites that automatically transfer people flagged for nudity. Every day, about 50,000 new men are trying to get naked, Turnovsky says. What we're doing is selling the naked men to a couple of websites. It's an investment for us.
Now, you know who's one of the guys behind Chat Roulette is Sean Parker.
Yeah.
Napster and the social network or whatever. And that Chat Roulette is one of those things that went from being a site no one had heard of to a site everybody had heard of, and everybody knew that the deal was just full of nude guys just working their route. You know, it was like one out of five hookups you would get on Chat Roulette would just be that. And we all suddenly had that knowledge within about 24 hours.
Yeah.
So it was, you talk about a thing that just obtained massive cultural currency, like interest, instantly.
So apparently, she said, once the site detects something fishy is going on, users are kicked from our service to another website. The profits from that referral traffic bring in $100,000 a month, or triple what the site earns through normal revenue.
Wow.
So until Chat Roulette finds new investors or figures out how to turn a more stable profit, Turnovsky remarks that 50,000 naked men is our investment.
Well, and really everything. We've talked about this before, that not only is technology all driven by video games and porn, but I mean, I would imagine that probably 70% of the revenue online is from video games and porn. I mean, at a bare minimum, if you were to look at all revenue created by all websites on the internet, if you leave aside, I mean, even if you factor in sort of the big power players like Yahoo and Google or whatever, all the rest is probably... It is probably an even split between gaming and boobs. That's it. I mean, that's what makes money online.
Well, we had talked earlier about about when people start figuring out that the internet and viral videos and that sort of thing are excellent for people who are exhibitionists. That, you know, you can do something,
right?
And if there's people like catching you on their cell phones, it's going to go on YouTube, and like, you know, 100,000 people will see you pull your junk out on the subway. So really, that's what Chat Roulette is. It's these guys. Now it's sort of like really, and I do this here, and it's going to like bump me over to an exhibitionist website. People will be looking at me who want to look at me. This is awesome.
Can I just tell you,
everyone wins, I guess.
I had the greatest idea. I had the greatest idea for a website a while back, and I know that we're now back onto the porn thing almost immediately. But hey, you know, everybody's got to be good at something. So what do you think of this idea as just a money maker? filmmaking venture, because we've been talking about, you know, ENN really ought to, the Emerson News Network should be branching out. And I think we were, what was the fetish we came up with last hour that we decided it might be a money-making?
Oh,
was it just you in high heels cooking, like making cookies for people?
Yeah, that was just ladies dressed up, not me necessarily, but ladies dressed up in sort of Donna Reed 50s outfits coming to your house and baking cookies.
Okay.
Or just photographs of them baking cookies.
So I was thinking about this, and this is the whole thing where it's the exhibitionism and the voyeurism and then the money-making and the whatever all tied in together. So it'd be like a Big Brother sort of a thing, like the British show, the Big Brother, where, you know, you have or the Real World where there's cameras in a house. And so you would have a house or an apartment, and there would just, with a bunch of, bedrooms or whatever, and the bedrooms would all be wired with cameras, and everybody would know this. I mean, people in the house would know. So you would have a house in which there were a bunch of bedrooms, and then you would have, the same kind of people who might otherwise go into, like, some sort of low-rent porn or whatever. They would just live in the house, and they would just, sort of just get it on as people normally do. And then it would be, and you would pay them for this. They would live in the house. They would, their rent would be covered. They would then be having, having the sex on camera, and this would all be paid for by people who would then subscribe to view the house online.
Well, even better, what if you had a house like that and you had people subscribe to watch the house online, but the people living in the house are exhibitionists and they would pay you to live in the house? So you get money from both sources.
No, I'm confused. No, I just don't.
Well, people who are exhibitionists,
right,
they would pay you
to
live in the house where all the people are watching. And then the people who want to watch pay you to watch. So you're getting money from both ends.
I feel like we've just entered some weird pornography who's on first thing. When you say they would pay you,
well,
who are you talking about?
Us, the people who are operating the house.
Oh, so not a figurative you, actually me.
Yeah.
In this case.
Yeah.
Okay. All right. Yes.
So you have the house, and then the people say, I want to watch people exhibit themselves. And they pay you to watch on the internet. And then you find people who actually want to exhibit themselves. And you say, look, we're going to get like hundreds of thousands of people watching you via internet. And then they pay you to live there.
See, and I think
you
it would
get both.
And I think it would make money too, because it wouldn't be like porn where it'd be contrived. In other words, it's not like they're living there and then, like, you know, you're scheduling times when they're going to go in the bedroom and have sex or whatever. They would just be living there as, like, yeah, normal people living in a normal house, but they would be, you know, they would not have a problem with exhibitionism, or at least, you know, they would be, okay with the understanding that their relations are going to be viewed by others, and the rent on the house is, yeah, then paid by people who watch. So it is sort of, so it basically would be like an uncensored version of Big Brother, and all of the costs are covered by then the subscribers. So, oh wait, apparently somebody's saying it's already been done.
Oh, well, never mind. By the way, speaking of which, I got an email. Which I believe you got the same email we were both copied on. Got an email from a listener who is at a furry convention.
I don't believe I saw that. Again, I'm running late this morning,
If
it arrived today, I wouldn't have seen it.
Yes, I received an email from a listener who said, subject title, Why Is There a Pig in My Bedroom? And you see, it's funny because it's a quote from the show. And I'm going to a furry convention tomorrow morning, which would be today,
uh-huh,
and the subject. He says, you guys will be missed when I'm there. I was in the worst mood today, and then I listened to today's Legion of News, and suddenly I was cackling gleefully to myself at my computer, and life didn't seem so bad. Enclosed is a photo of the sort of things your self-employed furry listeners wear at these things. Yes, that's a candid photo. Yes, we light up like faggy furries from Tron. I'm the one in the dress. I will out-crazy Richie Bristol anytime.
That's a strange email.
He also said, by the way, your show has been a constant companion for 10 years. It's honestly just been an unambiguous force of good. Don, you're the best thing to ever happen to his goddamn show. I remember when it was still F. Matt Peterson and his gun nut weird all over it.
All right, then. So, is who?
This was a listener, Matt.
Excellent.
And,
hello.
And there's a photo of listener Matt in a dress at a furry party.
All right. You have to show that to me, because I haven't. Yeah, I don't. I think I may have missed this email somehow.
They're apparently furries, and then they've put neon lights all over themselves and are flashing around.
That's awesome.
Isn't that nice?
All right.
But I wanted to email him back, and I forgot. I was going to email him.
You forgot.
I didn't. Forgot. I was going to email him back and ask him if he could call us.
From the furry convention.
Today, from the
Well,
furry
somebody's
convention.
On the phone now. I don't know who this is, but let's... hello, sir, madam, is the case, maybe.
Rick?
Hello, hi. Who is this?
Rick, it's Eastman.
Eastman, this is a listener, Noah, calling from New York.
Ah.
Not a guy calling from a furry convention, but still a welcome addition to the show anytime. I am fantastic, my friend. How are you? Speaking of guys who've been listening forever and ever, how's your life, sir?
I'm doing well. I actually just Mevo'd that when I called in, there was no call screener. So I said to myself, whenever someone picks up, they're not going to have an idea who this is.
We're sort of just rolling it out Don and Mike style now, where the calls just sort of they come on unfiltered. We find that it adds just that extra wrinkle of unpredictability and energy to the show. How is it? Are you still in New York, sir?
I am. I guess it keeps things fresh. That last person who's writing in the article about how your show has been a constant companion for 10 years, you can put me on that list, too.
So you have been listening since, 1999, probably?
Exactly. I was listening back in the days of Yahoo Broadcast and Portland to Portland. You said of me the last time I called in, you said I've called in virtually every iteration or incarnation of your show. You even said it's not officially christened until I call in. That was pretty nice.
No, that's true, because we've been on, I think since 1999, we've been on 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. I think it's the fifth version of the show since then. And there is always that moment of, the moment when Noah calls in from Buffalo, which I think is, or I have in my head that you're in Buffalo, because I think that's where you were when you first called us. So you are one of the things that we check off the list whenever we start a brand new version of the program.
Well, thank you. I was in school back in 99. I lived in Buffalo right until 2007, so that's why it's always strong in the head.
Hey, are you guys are you guys getting the whole like 6 feet of snow thing there? Are you guys, because you were going to get hit with the second half of that big snow hammer.
Yeah, we got about a foot of snow in this nor'easter the other day, but it was nothing. You got to remember, I survived blizzards of 15 and 16 feet, and I went to work the next day. So when I saw Mayor Bloomberg get all bent out of shape over 16 inches, I'm like, you're making the greatest city in the world look really weak.
See, and that's the thing. That's what we were talking about. Everybody here was like, we're going to get 3 inches of snow. And don't you think the schools closed yesterday just because they were thinking that there might be some kind of snow?
Because the roads were slick.
Yeah. And so, you know, he's like, oh, we just got a foot of snow the other day, but that's nothing.
By the way, whenever there is a whole lot of snow, start using the term snow hammer. We're trying to spread the phrase snow hammer.
So, and the snow hammer hit here the other day.
Right, exactly.
It was of a little consequence.
Because we started saying snowpocalypse, and then I feel like that was hijacked by the rest of the media. So, yes, snow hammer, you know, snowpocalypse is very 2000, that's very 2008. Snow hammer is the new snowpocalypse.
I'll put it on.
Awesome.
Rick,
yes, sir.
I was listening to your radio, before the show began, and just as the show began, it was the intro. The audio intro to the Dungeons & Dragons cartoon. I watched that in the 80s when I was growing up, back when Saturday morning cartoons were something people in our age group knew. They weren't the shallow shell of what they are today.
And so, let me ask you this question. So, do you remember at any point in the Dungeons and Dragons cartoon, was it ever explained what the relationship was between the Dungeon Master and Venger, who at one point, because there's this episode of the Dungeons and Dragons cartoon where, and I forget exactly what happened, but it was maybe like during the second season, where the Dungeon Master is talking to the kids who have, the kids have like made some mistake, or they've done something that caused like trouble, and then they had to, you know, fight demons or goblins or something. And at the end, Dungeon Master is doing this whole "What Did We Learn Today?" segment, and he says, "Children, everybody makes mistakes. Venger was mine." And then it just goes to the closing credits, and it was never explained, and it has haunted me for years.
Yeah, I actually have the answer. I think it was you or Don joked about it. I think it was you. You said, I'm too lazy to go online and look this up.
Yes.
I happen to remember this, and I just looked it up online to back it up.
All right.
I remember one time you said that your audience is awesome. You said your audience knows everything. You're like those guys in AI, where they get to go all the answers, and I was on the air at the time. I said, "Oh, you mean Dr. No?" And you laughed and said, "See what I mean?"
So you have, in fact, deduced,
I have the answer.
You have the answer. What is the answer to this then?
The reason Dungeon Master said he was my mistake is it's later revealed that Venger is Dungeon Master's son.
Oh, my God. I had no idea. So I guess I should have figured that out, because it's all just sort of the monomyth Joseph Campbell thing. But so Venger is, so he's, so it's not like a figure, like a creation, or like an assistant, or
it's not. He wasn't a disciple.
He wasn't an
apprentice.
No, it was an unfortunate roll in the hay.
It was an actual, so the Dungeon Master actually had children, one of whom at least was Venger, and Venger then left the side of good and fought for evil.
Right. I mean, there's plenty of religious allegorical references, but it's revealed. It's his son, and this is revealed in some episodes, and they follow it up in the final episode of Requiem, where it's again shown that it's his son.
Awesome.
And that's the whole reason this is all referred to that way.
Really? And this right here, this phone call is the reason that I consistently say that that we don't ever really have to research anything ourselves, because the audience will find the answer and they will bring it back to us. And that is one of the thousands of reasons why the audience continues to be like the greatest force, for knowledge on planet Earth. Excellent.
Trivia. Do you know who did the voice of Venger?
I don't. Was it Peter Cullen?
It was. Way to go, Rick.
That's right. Right there. That's Rick Emerson in the house for that. 3 points, baby. Brooklyn, we are incredibly over time, so we have got to skedaddle at this point, but it is always a pleasure when you call. Noah, alias Eastman. And why did you come from the East?
To do battle with the amazing Rando.
All right. Excellent. Thank you, my friend. Have a fantastic day.
Fantastic day. You too.
There you go. That is that's Noah. Hey, Don, how you doing over there?
I'm fine.
Share all your thoughts at this moment, please.
Oh, I was just thinking about how several years ago when we first met and I wrote that article for the Portland Tribune, and I started the thing by mentioning that you were running a contest where people could win Rush tickets by answering these Rush trivia questions or questions about Dungeons & Dragons.
Yeah.
And all the people just kept, your listeners just kept missing the Rush questions over and over and over again. And the very first guy was like, oh, I'll take the D&D question. And like, boom, knew it right out of the gate.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah, those are our people. All right, it is the Rick Emerson radio program. Thank you for. I should have guessed the thing that Venger would have been Dungeon Master's son.
Yeah.
I guess because
well,
that's, but it never.
Yeah.
But I guess I thought maybe like an apprentice or sort of a that it was the Smurfette to his Gargamel or something. But I just never really put it together. Mm-hmm. All right, it's the Rick Emerson radio program. I don't even know what the hell we've been talking about. This. Have we done a story? Yeah.
Yeah, we did the chat roulette story.
I guess, and that led us to the furry thing and the
right.
Whatever.
Mm-hmm.
All right, it's 503-505-6964. And now somebody's saying that it's no fair that I teased something earlier and that I held back and I didn't reveal my story after you talked about your friend dying of an aneurysm during sex.
Oh.
Rick, I thought one of the unspoken rules on the show was that if somebody weighed something as to whether or not it was appropriate to say out loud, they inevitably decided that it was, even if it really wasn't, if you know what I mean. And I do know what you mean. Okay, so I just because I said it was going to get me into trouble, and it's probably not. It's just it's one of those things. It sounds way worse than it is the thing. It sounds, I think it makes me sound creepier than I am. Really, is the deal.
I like it already.
No, I'm just. It's really. It's just that. And I won't use any names for this, but I will say. I'll just say that Laura and I years ago, and this we haven't seen them for a long time, but Laura and I, when we lived in California, we had some friends down there that I think had also they had lived in Utah and we had lived in Utah, and we both moved to the same city. Just coincidentally, we moved to Southern California. We moved to San Diego around the same time as this other couple, and that was just a coincidence. But they recommended some places to look, so we ended up actually not living that far from them. So even when we lived in San Diego, we actually had some people there down the street from us that we'd known for a couple of years. Anyway, so it was a couple, and at one point. One of the women in the couple, her younger sister, came to San Diego to live with them from like Virginia or some dirt covered state, and so the sister came out to live with them, and the sister I think at that time had just turned 18 and was an attractive young woman. She was an aesthetically pleasing specimen of female beauty, and anyway, so I don't even know. There's so much about this, so I don't even know how to really skip ahead to the now. But anyway, so this is a woman that we knew a long time ago, and we lived down the street from this couple and this younger sister who lived there, and the younger sister was very generously proportioned and also just the tiniest bit trashy, and that combination seems to manifest itself in clothing that is always way too small or perhaps where there's really just not enough coverage going on for polite interaction with the rest of society. She did appear to be underdressed a great deal of the time, and of course living in Southern California, you have the perfect people down there don't tend to, people at San Diego, if you live near the beach especially, they tend to not wear a lot of clothing just as a general rule, but even by those standards, it was like it was almost like she just had some sort of pathology about trying to get the attention of every man, every person in the room by wearing like as little clothing as possible. Anyway, so this is some time ago. So about 3 months ago, Laura and I are having a discussion about something in particular, and I forget what exactly it is I said that triggered this, but she just said, oh my God, do you remember, give me a name.
Bambi. Female.
Do you remember Bambi? And I said, Bambi, who lived down the street in San Diego. Yes, I do. I do remember Bambi. And she said, she just died. And I said, wow. And that was, you know, and that did actually catch me off guard because she wouldn't even have been 30. She would have been like 28, 29. And she said, she just died. I just talked to, you know, so-and-so, her older sister. Yeah, she died just out of the blue. It was very sudden. And I said, oh, that's weird. And it really is, you know, so you don't think about people like, you know, certain people you just don't, you figure that their death is like 60 years off. And so when it comes, you know, unexpectedly, you sort of, you know, you sit and you ponder the eternal verities and the mystery of life for a moment. And I said, oh, okay, well, that's really, you know, that's something, you know, boy, howdy, that life. And then when the conversation just kind of moved on to other things, because again, we hadn't seen her for like a decade. But I have to tell you that I did. This makes me sound so awful. This makes me sound like such a terrible person. But I did actually go online and Google her name just to see if there was going to be like an obituary or like a memorial notice or something that would have a current photo of her, because I was curious to see if she'd stayed hot. I really, and I know that makes me sound awful, but that's the sort of thing you wonder. But people ponder that sort of thing. As just before the internet, you had no way to know. It's like, unless you were able to dig up like a photograph, you know, or something, it was like find the newspaper from, you know, find the Lickskillet Journal or something, and, you know, to the obituary section. So I actually did go online and Google her name a few different times. And then I found myself typing her name and Googling Bambi St. Clair and then like Wake, you know. Or, you know, Bambi St. Clair, you know, is survived by as my other search term. And just sadly enough, by the way, I was never able to find a photograph of her. But I was just curious to see if she had remained a looker.
See? Yeah, that's a little sad.
But see, you see what I mean? It sounds creepier than it really is, though, I think.
Yeah, it does sound a little creepy. I would have probably done the same thing.
I was just curious.
Yeah.
Just as people do with, like, somebody you go to high school with, you know, or if it's like a, you know, if it's an ex or the one of your first serious boyfriend or girlfriend, you say, what if Joe looks just as good as he did back in high school? This is like that.
The answer is almost always no.
Almost no. And
is good, because then you look at yourself and you go, you know, actually, I'm holding up pretty well.
So it's, see, you know, that's
all things considered.
It is a thing that everybody does, except I didn't know her in high school, and also she was dead. The end.
I was thinking that story was going to go in a completely different direction. You were going to say something like, your first thought was like, oh, well, if she's dead, I probably should have done her when I had the chance.
Well, you know, well, that is well. Hey, let me ask you this, though. Speaking of that, have you ever thought about how old were you when you lost your virginity, when you first had relations?
I was 16.
Now, was it a person about your age, or was it, as I would imagine, a man much older?
He was 2 years older.
Okay. Have you ever been with a guy, though, who's much older than you?
Oh, yes.
So what is the greatest age distance?
Oh, seriously? Do I have to tell this?
Yes. Well, then I'll reveal mine, too. But it's leading up to a larger question.
Okay. Can I explain that I didn't know that this guy was that old?
Can I tell you that it doesn't matter? I'm not going to. I just talked about Googling a dead chick because I wanted to see her photograph.
Okay, I was like 19 or 20, and I went home with one of my mom's friends from like this bar that we drank in, who was this very vigorous Hawaiian gentleman.
Vigorous.
Yeah, he was. I mean, I figured he was, you know, in his mid to late 50s or something, but he was quite vigorous. And anyway,
what does that mean? He's quite vigorous. You're just saying he had a lust for life.
Well, you know, when people get into their 50s and 60s or whatever, they start slowing down a little. But he
had a spark, a vitality.
He was quite athletic and very physically fit and very tan. But again,
no, I got it.
Hawaiian. And so anyway, yeah, and I went home with him, and it was it was not the most pleasant experience. But anyway, you know, when you're drunk and you're 20 and you go home with one of your mom's friends at a bar, it's not necessarily going to be great. But anyway, I told my mom about it later, and my mom just started laughing and laughing uproariously, because I guess certain ethnicities, the Hawaiians, for example, apparently maintain their youthful demeanor well beyond the age of, say, Caucasians, and he was 72.
Wow. I did not expect that story to end that way.
And
you were how old?
I was 20.
Wow. Wow, wow, wow.
And I was...
Did he perform like a 72-year-old man or like a much younger man?
No, he performed much like a much younger man who'd had a whole lot to drink.
And, satisfactory.
Yes. Yeah, he would. He wanted me. No.
You can't not. Google dead girl. You have to. You can't not.
As I recall, he wanted me to call him daddy. And then afterwards, he fell asleep, and I grabbed my clothes, and I snuck out really quietly, and I, walked home. I believe I even ran part of the way home because I was afraid he would come out looking for me, and I'd have to explain why I was leaving.
I was
horrified by the whole thing afterwards, and then extra horrified when my mom told me how old he actually was.
Now, can I just tell you this, by the way, that I expected the story to end with the revelation that your mom had bonked him at some point. That was like I expected. And your mom said, hey, did he do that thing where, he did that thing where he asked you to call him daddy, and you go, oh, mom, how do you know? And then there's suddenly the violin stab as you realize.
I have now officially told one of the stories that I swore I was never, ever, ever going to share on
the air. The thing is, that's not that
bad.
But in the grand scheme of things, that's not that bad of a story. Just that he ended up being kind of an old guy. The thing about the daddy, here's the thing about guys need to know this. That sort of thing only works if it's the chick's idea. That's the thing. If the guy volunteers that, or if the guy tries to push things in that direction, that never works. That has to be her idea. That is like when. There's that thing in Cosmo. There'll be these how to spice things up or whatever. And they always talk about the dirty talk. And I always tell guys, it's your idea of what dirty talk is and her idea. All things being equal, I mean, generally speaking, women don't have the same notions for the dirty sex talk as guys do. And so occasionally they will have they'll say encourage your man to use spicier language in bed. My response is always to let her start that, because that will indicate where the bar is sort of set. Because if she just asks you to say whatever's on your mind, and then it's you're immediately coming out with something about her and her mom and a guy in an elk suit, and it's just, or whatever, and then she's just going to be so horrified. Women, if they could just look in the side of the guy's head through a little window and see what guys were thinking a lot of the time, they would be so shaken to their core. They would never have relations again.
Yeah. Also keep in mind that if we're in flagrante and you look at us and you say, talk to me. We have no idea what to say.
Yeah.
And now we just feel awkward and stupid. And
yeah.
It's like, and anything we say is not going to be sincere or from the heart. It's just going to be something that we think you want to hear because you saw it in a dirty movie
once.
Yeah,
but it's the opposite for guys. It's like, you'll say,
and it's really, really not sexy.
So then women are conjuring up what they think we want to hear, and guys, on the other hand, end up being way too honest and then horrifying the woman who then realizes she's in bed with some horrible deviant freak or whatever. Okay, so that's not how I expected that story to end. So all things being equal, that was actually pretty tame, because it wasn't like you and your mom had effed the same guy or something decades apart.
No.
Okay, well, I was just going to say, I was going to make this observation, about how I was Googling the dead hot girl. I'm 37 now, so okay. So I was thinking about I've told the story before that when I was 20, I think I had just turned 21. So it was a couple years, 18 months or so, where I was seeing this woman who was 43. And so which is a huge age. That's 16, I think.
Yeah.
We were 16 years apart. But I was thinking.
My biggest difference in that direction is 14 years.
Yeah.
So.
And so I was thinking about, the fact that, so now I'm 37, so 47. So she's what? She's, if I'm 37, she's 50. Let's see. If I was 21 and she was 43, I can't do any math today. That's what, 12 years?
37 minus 21 is 15.
What is the difference between 21 and 43? I can't, seriously, my brain is not working today. How many years difference is 21 and 43? 22. Okay, I'm not carrying the one. 22. Okay,
right.
So how old would she be now?
She was 43 and you were 21.
Yeah.
So she was 22 years older than you.
So she'd be 59.
She'd be 22 years old. Older than you are right now.
So that's 59.
Yeah.
Okay, 59. So this is really why I say I can't do Thursdays, because even the simplest amount of math is eluding me. But so then I was thinking she's 59, and I started thinking what she probably looks like now. And then I realized I'm going to get to that point, within the next decade or so, where somebody that I will have slept with is probably dead of natural causes. And that, I think, is when you really have to start realizing that you yourself have become old, when somebody that you have been with in the past has probably passed away from old age.
Yeah. Of course, if they live old enough, if they live long enough and you live long enough, the age difference won't seem that great.
Well, I guess. But I'm just saying it's like, but it's not even really about the age difference. It's just the idea, you know, it's just the idea that you have lived long enough that one of your romantic partners has died of old age.
Yeah.
Okay.
That's depressing.
What an odd program this has been already today.
Yeah.
Okay. People are just typing in the text box. Honestly? Really? Really? I didn't even. The great thing is, I don't even know what this is.
Doesn't matter.
I don't even know what this is in reference to.
They're just talking about the show in general at this point. Really?
Okay.
Both of our watches are about death.
Well, let's just do one of them now.
Let's do the Corpse Watch because it seems to be, you know, a theme that we're doing here.
Good God. All right, we're going to do Corpse Watch. Then we'll have another installment of the greatest songs ever made. Later on in the day, we got your Snuff Watch coming up. And we'll also have top five songs about drinking. And there's a strangeness in the air. All right, let's see. Here is your Corpse Watch for Thursday right here in the Rick Emerson radio program.
I'm digging up bones. I'm digging up bones. Exhuming things that's better left alone. But I'm resurrecting memories of love that's dead and gone. Yet tonight I'm sitting alone, digging up bones.
Cheryl just said, you're depressing everyone everywhere. Okay, thanks so much. Here is your Corpse Watch for Thursday on the Rick Emerson radio program.
Well, continuing today's theme, police say an Ohio man is accused of having sex with a corpse, but he told investigators he didn't realize at first that she was dead.
It's hard to say who that reflects more poorly upon.
55-year-old Richard Elwood Sandin of Geneva, Ohio, is being held on $500,000 bond Wednesday. He was being held on charges of abusing a corpse and possession of marijuana. The Washington Times Herald reports police arrested Sandin on Saturday night after they were called to the dead woman's apartment. The newspaper reports that Sandin told police he was having sex with the 48-year-old woman whom he'd known for a few months when he realized she wasn't breathing.
So this, I mean, was she alive, does he believe, at the beginning of the act? In other words, was this mid-coitus expiration?
Well, that's what he is claiming, I guess.
She was always very taciturn about her. She was always somewhat reserved.
Although I suppose, you know, it's possible he just, like, crept in and thought she was sleeping. Figured he'd surprise, it's my penis. But it's...
Coming this fall to Fox Television, Don Taylor in Surprise, It's My Penis.
But he, The guy told police he administered CPR and called an ambulance. But
sounds like CPR might stand for something else.
It just sounds really sad, though, that it's like if his story is true, it's terrible. And then they're holding him on charges of abusing a corpse and he has to go, but she was alive when I started.
But I'm such a lackluster maker of love that she always just lay there as though I were not even in the room. So that's like the general response that he elicited from her during lovemaking. Most of the time was just like a near catatonic ignorance or indifference.
Maybe.
That's his story, right? Is that like it's like it wasn't his defense is essentially this is just like the sex we always have.
Well, he also said he didn't realize at first that she was dead. So,
but then there was a sort of a cooling,
which leads one to believe that perhaps he then immediately leapt off of her before finishing. But we don't know that for a fact.
Somebody's just typing, oh, my God, what is wrong with today? You're harshing our mellow. All right. I'm just curious as to whether, I mean, when he didn't realize at first, so he.
Well, I'll tell you, there are some men who get really sort of in, let's just say, into their own headspace, as it were, where they like.
His mind was on other things.
Yeah. They'll clench their eyes really tight and then
please
just...
don't do that. Why did you just do that? I know what that looks like. Why would you recreate that for me?
And then they're just like not looking at you and they're just doing what they're doing. And so honestly, you could be dead and they wouldn't notice for like another 10 minutes.
Never, never more have I felt like we should have had somebody else in the studio today just to get us back on point.
Oh, Cheryl hates us both right now.
I was just going to say, even this is one of those things where even having like Sarah in the studio, who would have just started shrieking and saying, oh my God, and like would have pulled off her headphones. That might, even that nuclear option might have been advisable today because now we're just so deep into this. All right. Okay.
By the way, I got an we got an email from someone who wants to know about the slutty chick who died too young. I'm sure a lot of us are curious about what she died of. If you said it, I missed it, and I apologize. If you didn't, we're all wondering what an under 30 would be dying of. Cancer? Traffic accident? Heart attack? Drug overdose?
Well,
choking on a tuna sandwich?
I assumed, and again, I won't reveal anything else about her because it's, I don't know. I assumed that it was either, that she either OD'd on something or that it was a, or that it was a car accident. So, but again, it's like I, you know, I didn't really, you know, like I, you know, I did like the one search, and there was just really nothing there. And then it's like there is no like Google for just like there's no obituary for you know like search on Google or something. It's not like, you know, you've,
and a lot of obituaries don't even say anymore.
Yeah, well, that's the thing, is like a lot of time, you know, it's like with Google, you do like, unless it's somebody who's notable in some way, you do the one search and nothing comes up, like you realize you're kind of at a dead end. So for good or bad, I really, the Googling lasted about 7 seconds, and then I realized there's nothing there. But yeah, a lot of obituaries are just, you know, is survived by, will rest in our hearts forever. But there was no actual further, you know, discussion. You'll see that where you read somebody's obituary and you're like, well, there's no other, you know, there's not any additional explication. But I think, and the younger somebody is, the more likely it is that they will be vague about that, because which you think would be the opposite, right? Because if you're young, everybody's going to assume that it's just like you just OD'd on heroin or something. You figure if it's a car accident or if it's, you know, if it's like you had some sort of a disease, a cancer or something, they would probably tell you so that you don't leap to your own conclusions of, you know, like shot during a drug deal, which is exactly what... Somebody says, all this for just 32 cents a day. Probably, you know, and then somebody else notes that, surprise, it's my penis is the worst birthday greeting ever. Okay. Okay. All right. I'm sorry.
You could play the ending.
Are we
music.
Done with that?
Oh, God, okay. I hope so.
All right, there's the...
I'm digging up bones, I'm digging up bones, exhuming things that's better left alone.
We shouldn't be left unattended and unsupervised.
Resurrecting memories of love that's dead and gone, yet tonight I'm sitting alone, digging up bones.
We talked at one point about having Cheryl actually here, but I think she didn't want to. And
yeah.
I really can't blame her.
And I think she would have, I mean, it's like, you think about it, like, really, what is she going to do other than just like, I mean, is she just going to like, I guess she could just like turn her head and look at us and just arch an eyebrow, yeah. You know, or just, you know, or just pepper
spray. Shake her head sadly, just to, you know, shame us.
For people who, you know, this is people like occasionally who listen to Legion of News will ask what the difference is between Legion of News and this show. And I think that is, I think that point has been brought into stark relief.
We talk about porn and death a lot more here.
Yeah. Yeah.
And our iPhones. Those are the three top topics, I think, of the last few months. Porn, death, and iPhones.
All right. Okay. I'm not even going to, you know, I see the little thing indicating there's a new message from Cheryl, and I'm just going to minimize that for now. I'll read that here in a few minutes. Just, I'm just not going to look at that now. Okay. Here's what's coming up later on the day. We got your snuff watch. Just to stay on task. Also, your top five songs about drinking. We got the greatest songs ever made. And it seems this is the most, it really, even by our standards, this is the most inappropriate time ever to do a commercial. So we're not going to talk about it. We'll do our client mention here in just a bit. I feel doing that now might be that might be ill-advised. We should read one non-corpse, non-sex story. And then we'll do greatest songs ever. And then we'll come back with a renewed sense of focus and purpose.
Let's see what I got here.
Jesus,
something,
God almighty.
A little less...
This, by the way, is what's kept guys like Noah listening for 12 years. It's this kind of unpredictability.
Okay. Well, let's try this one. Let's see. Where did I put that? Ah, here we go.
Okay.
I have just a huge stack of papers on the desk here.
All right.
A Missouri man is facing charges after allegedly backing up demands for fast food with a shotgun. Chris Brooks Huring, 27, of rural Benton, Missouri, is charged with unlawful use of a weapon and driving while intoxicated. The county sheriff, Rick Walter, said his department received the call about 11:40 p.m. Saturday regarding a man with a shotgun at a drive-thru window at McDonald's. They had told him the store was closed. Walter said he demanded one of the employees open the window. The employee reportedly responded by advising only the manager could open the window. He told the employee he wanted food and pointed the shotgun at him. He said, if I don't bring some food home for my wife, she's going to kill me. At that point, the employees didn't want to stick around to listen to any more demands.
Hey, here's a fun fact. You know, if you go to a McDonald's, not all of them, but if you go to a McDonald's in Portland, there's like a 1 in 3 chance that when you're placing your order, you're talking to a guy in Fargo, North Dakota.
I knew that there were some fast food places that were doing that.
McDonald's does that. They outsource, and it is literally Fargo. There was an article the other day, like in the, I don't know, it was like some economic piece about Fargo and how Fargo is like, sounds silly, but Fargo has a thriving economy. That like there, like people in Fargo, they have like an unemployment rate that's like 1/3 the rest of the nation. And one of the reasons is that they have started taking contracts from companies like that. So with the guy who actually hands you your food, obviously, is at the restaurant. But the first half of that, when you're saying, like, I like a filet of fish and 2 large fries, you're talking to a guy in North Dakota who then types the information up on a screen and it comes back here to the guy in Portland who knows what to get you then.
That it is so strange because that really does not seem like it would be cost effective, but I guess...
Except that guy's taking orders for 15 different restaurants. And so you're basically, even if you pay him $10 an hour, that is, you know, for 10 restaurants, that's effectively $1 an hour for each restaurant as opposed to $8 an hour. So it's a $7 an hour net savings for each of the businesses.
Yeah, I'm fascinated by that kind of thing, that the different cost-cutting measures that restaurants at fast food places are particularly figuring out to do, like Chipotle. They have an online thing and they have an app on the phone so you can order your food ahead and then just go and then you walk right up to the register and pick it up and you don't have to do that thing of standing in the line because Chipotle is sort of like Subway where you walk through the line and you go, I want that meat and I want those beans and I want that and they build it for you down an assembly line and then you pay at the end. But if you order ahead on the app or online, you can just walk straight to the register and pay for it. It's already waiting for you. And at least the one by my house in Tualatin, if you order ahead on the weekend, they'll give you like one burrito free of the two you've paid for. They'll actually like not charge me for the second burrito because they so desperately wish people would start doing this.
Right.
They want you to start ordering online and doing this so that everything's taken care of ahead of time. And it makes everything go faster and it makes the line in the store go through faster. And so we'll give you free food if you start doing this thing online just so we can teach you to do it.
Well, that's like the banks who are like, you know, they're offering the financial incentives if you just do everything through the automated teller as opposed to talking to an actual person, which I've used to resist, but I've started doing it more and more. Well, like, you know, with my iPhone, do you have that thing on your... do you have the thing with your iPhone where you handle your bill and all of your accounts via the app?
Yeah.
Yeah, which is just fantastic, which I'm sure there's something like that for Android phones, but it's amazing.
Well, also, like we talked about this, Chase and a couple of other banks have a thing now. It's an app for the iPhone where you can take a picture of the front and the back of an endorsed check.
Right.
And it will deposit it into your account. You don't actually have to even go to the bank if someone has written you a check.
That's amazing. I should totally do that. I think you mentioned it, but I haven't actually done it yet.
Yeah.
I should try that today because I got like a bunch of crap I have to stick in the bank. All right. We should take a break here.
Anyway, the McDonald's guys, basically he was thwarted because the employees just backed away from the window to get away from him and his shotgun and then called the police. And a deputy was about a minute away and he arrived and got the guy and... The shotgun was loaded, and there was a round chambered, so apparently he did intend to shoot someone if he didn't get any McDonald's food.
He was really going to follow through on that.
He really was, but it failed. It failed because of the employees and their crafty technique of backing away from the window.
Somebody's asking if we're going to submit today's show for that Crystal Award that I was talking about yesterday from the National Association of Broadcasters, so we can for community service.
Well, I know Robert Wagner said something about one of his shows on Cascadia. I think it was Suck It, and he was talking to Betsy Richter about being on the show or doing something. He said, "Well, no, because the show that we're doing today, I'm going to be using." As a sample at a business meeting.
Awesome.
And so I thought, yeah, this will be that show for us. This is the one we're going to use to submit to possible investors in ENN.
It says, you two are like children in a room with pots, pans, matches, knives, markers, crayons, Play-Doh, and paint. Okay, thanks. Yeah.
Except it's thousands of dollars of electronic equipment.
God damn. All right. It is the Rick Emerson Radio Program. God, it's almost 3 o'clock, and it just feels like we have tons of stuff still to do, because we do.
I
got nowhere to be.
I don't either.
We have your top five coming up later on today. Top five songs about drinking. We'll also get to your snuff watch and so forth. We'll talk about also what is going to become of the Name That Snack contest as well. Don't forget to join us a couple bits of business tomorrow when Big Jim Willig will be in the studio for Humor Me Comedy 101. Also tomorrow. tomorrow night, his show at the Baghdad. Mm-hmm. He's going to be headlining at the Baghdad tomorrow, so we'll talk to him about that. His installment of Humor Me Comedy 101 tomorrow is focusing on what we'll call a polarizing figure, who I quite like.
And, I do, too.
Margaret Cho is going to be the focus of tomorrow. And there's a lot of people who just recoil or they groan reflexively at the sound of her name. But it's going to be an interesting discussion. So that'll be tomorrow. We'll talk about his show at the Baghdad. And then tomorrow on funemploymentradio.com, Mr. Ben Bailey, who's the host of Cash Cab, will be their guest. So that'll be it. So I, too, am going to find a reason to come back to the studio. And just, did I leave my ballpoint pen? Ben Bailey, look at you.
We're both going to be just sitting in the kitchen with our laptops like, oh, we just had so much work to do. We had to stay here. Why, hello there. Lovely to meet you.
It's awesome.
Can I sniff you? Okay, that would be me, not you.
Yeah, thanks.
I can't wait to smell him.
Okay. Anyway, remember that moment we weren't going to be creepy anymore? So that's tomorrow at funemploymentradio.com. And then Saturday, Aaron Duran has the signing and unveiling and release of La Brea, his new comic book, the first comic from Geek in the City Comics. And so that is going to be at
Bridge City Comics.
Bridge City Comics, Saturday from 6 to 9 p.m. You can find out more about that at geekinthecity.com. All right, coming up in just moments, greatest songs ever made later on, Snuffwatch and all that. You're listening to the Rick Emerson Radio Program.
You're listening to the Emerson News Network.
I'm Rick Emerson, and these are the greatest songs ever made. In music, your hopes are often confounded. Your expectations, however, are usually accurate to within a micrometer. When a long-dormant band releases their comeback album or their reunion record, you hope for the best. You expect something more modest, though. When a singer who's clearly a one-hit wonder attempts a full-length follow-up, or when your favorite pop metal band creates a four-sided concept album, you know what you're probably going to get. You cross your fingers and you pray to the god of your understanding, but you have a sense of realism about how things will likely turn out. All of which makes it even more electric when a musical act completely and totally exceeds, subverts, or, in the case of today's song, obliterates what people probably thought was coming. After all, following a novelty release, or what was often labeled a novelty release, is challenging enough. Add to this the cross-cultural sensibility of the act, which, while obviously sincere, did seem to make the odds of a two-for-two streak rather long. What else? How about a rancorous departure from their record label? How about a bitter public fight with the producer of their breakthrough album, who, rightly or wrongly, had been perceived as the real force behind their success? How about the fact that they were still in the relatively uncharted waters of a musical style only recently gone mainstream? It's safe to say that when 1989 dawned, no one expected much of anything. But they weren't counting on several things. On the power of magical collaboration, for example. On the power of pure hunger and drive to prove oneself. On the power of an unabashed love for the art form in which they worked. And the complete and overwhelming sense of, well, crazy, which made and makes them what they were and are. Who, after all, would reference Mardi Gras, Club Med, Lava Lamps, Patty Duke, Fred Flintstone, New York City, of course, and perhaps most memorably, Sam the Butcher, all in one song? And the production. Who would sample Rose Royce, Foxy, the Funky 4+1, James Brown, Africa Bambaataa, Bob Marley, the Sugar Hill Gang, Paul Humphrey, Willie Bobo, Shelly Manne, and the Bar Kays? All in one song. Who could possibly see the commercial and artistic potential in what their co-producers Mike Simpson and John King had put together, a production style so game-changing that even now, decades later, it hasn't been matched or exceeded in terms of pure, unhinged ambition? Why, nobody. Nobody at all. But the group behind Fight for Your Right to Party, the group behind License to Ill, the group from whom no one expected much of anything. But that, of course, was before people had heard Paul's Boutique, the first song from which is one of the greatest songs ever made, requesting, exhorting, nay, ordering you, that's you, Don Taylor, to shake your rump. This is the Beastie Boys on the Emerson News Network.
Routines and rhymes. Adam Horowitz. Hurricane. You got cloud. Other DJs, put your head out.
I'm popping on a string. I'm paid to sing a rhyme. I do my thing. I'm in a lava lamp. It's in my brain. Don't tell me why I'm not preaching the pigeon. But I rock well.
The Betty Duke.
The Prince.
And then I was the bingo. Got more rhymes than Jamaican got mango.
I got a big link. That's the end of my stove bar.
Hey, yo, rope.
Michael Diamond?
No, mine's Clavin.
From downtown
Manhattan,
the village. My style's wild, and you know that it's still it.
This snow bag's up, and then you're doing the ball.
Shake your rope.
To the Emerson News Network.
All right, then. All right, things seem incrementally more balanced now. Yes, all right. Really, the girl from Ipanema can calm even the even the most frenetic program. It is the Rick Emerson Radio Program brought to you by Squires Electric. Find out more about them by going to squireselectric.com. You can also phone them if you like. It's 503-252-1609. You'd like to have them come to your home or to your business. Maybe it's a business that maybe it's a business to be, a business that does not yet, as of this moment, exist, but you're already planning. You're looking at, you know, it's that whole thing we've talked about several times over the last week or so, because we've had that, you know, the listener of ours that is building a gym where you've got to do, I mean, it is the number of steps required in starting any business. I mean, are just seemingly endless. But in fact, if you're going to actually have to build the structure, if you're going to remodel the inside of a building, I mean, just to do this show here, we didn't realize it. It's not like we had to remove any walls or anything, you know. And the building was essentially was wired. In fact, wired by Squires Electric. But just bringing in the small amount of equipment we use, it really was just. It was a job of Gaussian proportions. But God forbid you have to tear out the wiring that's in there already, and you have to get it upgraded, or you have to get it approved by inspectors. I mean, if the people that were there before were doing a different kind of business altogether, you might have to literally remove everything and have it all replaced. And you don't want to try to bite all that off yourself. It's just going to be, that way lies madness, my friends. So you contact Squires Electric at 503-252-1609, 503-252-1609. They are licensed, bonded, and insured electrical installers, contractors, and supervisors. They can make sure that it's done right. They can make sure it's done right the first time. And of course, not just at your business, it's at your home as well. So if you're thinking about putting a different, adding a room into your home, or you're going to be consolidating, you know, two rooms, you can do what my parents did, which is as soon as any of the kids moved away from home, like literally as the car was pulling out of the driveway, my dad would be in there with a sledgehammer just knocking out walls and eliminating the bedrooms so they could never move back. You know, that's the sort of thing you want to make sure that you do it properly, especially if you're going to be consolidating the wiring between the two rooms. So you can get a free estimate so you know right up top about how much it's going to cost you. No job too small or too large. They recently, at the end of last year, they did a five-story building of condominiums, and it actually started, you know, that guy had discovered Squires Electric, and they came to his house to fix literally one single outlet, an actual one outlet in one room of his house. 503-252-1609. That's 503-252-1609, or you can find them online at squireselectric.com. It is squireselectric.com. Proud sponsors of this, the Rick Emerson Radio Program.
You're listening to the Emerson News Network.
It is the Rick Emerson Radio Program. Thank you for joining us. It's 503-505-6964. 503-505-6964. 509-6564. You can also email if you like. It's rick@rickemerson.com. That is rick@rickemerson.com. Hello, Don Taylor. How are you?
I'm excellent. How are you?
I'm okay. I am. I'm getting today's top five. I was going to say locked and loaded, but I don't wish to be chastised by the mainstream media, Don.
No, there's no room for that sort of rhetoric in
provocative language.
In the current climate.
No. So I'm preparing the top five. We'll do the top five songs about... That's what I like about you, Don. You're a real straight shooter.
Doing finger guns at you. Pew, pew, pew.
We've also got your snuff watch on the way as well. Don't forget to join us tomorrow when we'll have Mr. Big Jim Willig in the studio. And tomorrow, Sarah X. Dillon and Greg Nibbler are going to be talking to Ben Bailey from Cash Cab at FunEmploymentRadio.com. At the news desk, it is Don Taylor. You know, by the way, just before I even launch that, you know whose fault this whole thing is? Today's program, and it's rather morbid, bent. This is all the fault of...
Jeff Futzer.
Jeff Futzer. This is all the fault of Jeff Futzer and his question about what to do when a friend of yours, dives, and then how do you deal with their Facebook account?
Yeah, it just set the tone for the whole day.
He's the one who set us on this path to begin with. So
I think from here on out we will just refer to that as a Futzer.
Pulling a Futzer.
That was pulling a Futzer.
So if the program is taken off the rails in some what is later realized to be a very regrettable fashion.
All right. Today was a total Futzer.
Really, we just Futzered the entire thing right from jump. At the news desk, Don Taylor.
And now, from the news desk, this is Don Taylor.
Two central Alberta, Canada farmers served up some cold hard justice to an alleged fuel thief on their property, leaving him tied up and pantsless in the snow until
Mounties
arrived.
Tied up and pantsless. I would have an album just so I can call it Rick Emerson, Tied Up and Pantsless.
Having fallen victim to a thief at their ranch near Tartu, east of Olds, Alberta, Canada, a handful of times, Tim Lynch and his son Chris sprang into action Wednesday morning when they were alerted to a truck on the property with similar tire tracks that they have seen before. Chris confronted the man in an attempt to delay him from fleeing and realized the unwanted visitor may have been sitting in a stolen truck. Chris said, he put it in gear and put it to the floor. I jumped on the running board and held onto the steering wheel and reached in and grabbed the stick shift and held it in park. I was yelling at Dad to get the guy out of the truck. He managed to get in the truck, but the man threw it back into drive and took the pair on a ride across the yard as they struggled. When the truck again was stopped, Chris then wrestled with the man in the back seat, avoiding swings of a pry bar while his dad ran for a rope.
Jesus.
I got him in a headlock until Dad got the rope around his feet, he said. The duo then dropped to the man, who was wearing pajama pants but no underwear, into the snow, and Chris said, quote, his bare ass was hanging out. We tied it around his ankles. I'm assuming they mean the rope. And then grabbed another rope and tied his hands up, and the police arrived about 40 minutes later.
Okay.
The elder Lynch said, you come across someone threatening your livelihood and family, it's an instinct. We work with cattle. It works with them, so we figured it would work with
them. That was exactly when he said that they had him down and they were tying him up around the ankles. I was thinking that, you know, as much as I say that the things you see at the rodeo are not life skills that can be applied to any other circumstance, this is the sort of story that exists as an exception to that rule, is to prove that those things are occasionally called upon in your day-to-day existence. Well done. Excellent. It is the Rick Emerson Radio Program. Don't forget, we get to your top five coming up here in just a discussion. How was yesterday's ham-fisted radio, by chance?
It was delightful. It was fine. It was another one of those episodes where Bobby and I just talked about how we have this tendency often to get off on the subject of the poor social skills of others on the internet, and how we, from our vast vantage point of having been interacting with people on the internet since like the days of Usenet, we somehow have like grown through and past the whole thing of needing to be argumentative and angry.
Well, you've already gone through. You've gone through and left behind your troll stage.
Right. Yes. Yeah. We're way past the troll stage. So we tend to find it kind of interesting that so many people are in the troll stage, but then, you know, there's this vast amount of youngins that came after us. So we tend to talk about that a lot. We were talking about that yesterday, a great deal of that. And also, we try to school listeners a little bit on the fact that the life skills that they learn on internet message boards are not life skills that are useful at all in real interactions with actual people.
Please to explain.
Well, for one thing, when you're actually having a conversation with a person in real life and you disagree with them about something, the proper response is not to immediately try to one-up them with the meanest insult you can possibly think of.
Right.
You know, you may get really, really good at that on the internet, but it's not going to help you have good social skills that might help you, I don't know, meet girls make actual friends.
I was actually talking to somebody about this on Tuesday. It must have been. I was talking to somebody about something or other, and we started talking about message boards and forums and moderation and the people who administrate message boards and how that is a thankless and unheralded job, being a moderator on a message board. I mean, especially if you're a moderator that does their job, if you're a moderator that actually does it the way it needs to be done. And I brought up the website of Television Without Pity, and Television Without Pity is a fine website. I don't spend a lot of time there just because it's like, you know, because I spend so much of my daily existence talking about television anyway, that it's like that's a thing of taking my job home with me. If I were to go home and just spend all night on a message board, you know, about about JAG or something, so as I would do if left to my own devices. What about Army Wives season 7? Can I just tell you this, by the way, just as a side note? When I was in Kennewick this past weekend. Can I just tell you, one of the great moments of my life is when somebody similar to but legally distinct from me was, because my mother has, she doesn't have cable right now, and of course, you know, and she was missing her Army Wives, and and so somebody not unlike your humble narrator was teaching his mother about something that rhymes with Mitmorant, and. And the ability to glean episodes of Army Wives from the Intertron, should she feel the need to get caught up. Anyway, I was talking to somebody about the Television Without Pity message board, and the great thing about going to that forum is that they are upfront about the fact that it's like that it is not a democracy, and that like you will behave civilly, and if you don't, like they will, like the banhammer will hit you like nobody's business. The best example of this, if you go to Television Without Pity, which I think is just TWOP.com, one of the rules for posting on their message board is that you may not begin a post of any kind with the words or . And they give an explanation. They say, because if you respond to somebody and your first word is you are not trying to correct them politely. You are being a condescending jackass.
Yeah.
They said that there is no way to start a message board post with the word without just being a dick. They said, and don't tell us you're not doing it because we know better. You can lie, but we know you're just trying to be a jagoff. And so they will give you a warning. And they said, if we have to tell you more than twice, like we will ban you temporarily. If you do it again, we'll ban you permanently. And they're really, and they said, if you don't like it, it's not a democracy. Go somewhere else to talk. But as a result, those are completely, and it's not like they mind heated or very like passionate in debate. They just won't let you, they won't let flame wars happen, and they won't let people troll. And as a result, it's a great place to go and read a lot about television if you want to, because there's a whole lot of people who not only are they not working through the trolling stage, they just have no desire to ever leave that. To them, that is the only reason that the internet exists, is so they can just sit and just yank the virtual chains of others. So, no, I'm with you on that.
Yeah. And one of the things we've talked about is that, you know, he and I both, yes, we have that history. We both were there. We were there during,
don't know about Pine.
We cut our teeth on Usenet and on just, you know, sitting there basically doing the message board thing of like every single day going, oh, and this person is my enemy and I must show him up for all of the other, you know, 40 people who are reading this, you know, forum. And it's just stupid, and it's just idiotic. And as Bobby kept pointing out, you're spending hours and hours, days, months of your life writing and being creative. And it's just, and you're just throwing
but
it away.
For crap.
You're just throwing it away at crap. And it's interesting when you come through that and come out the other side. And I have sort of created this world for myself now where I don't engage in that kind of thing at all. And in fact, I often feel sometimes like in the old movies, the fella who is the black belt in karate, whose hands are a lethal weapon, and he must live a life of peace because otherwise, you know, if he breaks it out at all, he will kill someone.
Right.
So like, and so Bobby's kind of the same way, where we get that thing where someone will send us like hate mail. You'll get like, you know, a comment on something about some movie review we've written or hate mail or something like that. And you have that moment of, oh, sir, don't poke the tiger in the tiger cage.
Right.
You really don't want to see, you really don't understand how good I am
you
at
wouldn't
this.
Like me when I'm angry.
Yeah. And so you just kind of go, you take a breath and you go, I will choose to ignore this, or I will respond so politely that it will shame them that they were so over the top. I will write back and say, "Well, thank you very much for pointing that out." You know, but it's like you always have that moment where you just kind of go, "Yeah, no, I don't do that anymore."
Or it's that was the old me. Yes. I have left that way behind.
Exactly.
There are the three different levels of responding. There's I won't identify the first person, but there's somebody I know who a person who's in the public eye to some degree, and just like monitors not just like the email inbox but like message boards and, you know, everywhere on the internet for any mention of themselves, and just to any like perceived slight will then respond back in like a public forum on a message board. Will, you know, if somebody has the temerity knock what they do in just any tiny way, will respond back at like 2 a.m. with like a page and a half of like angry, but, you know, but really well thought out, and then all, you know, but all the sadder because of that, really like well thought out point for point refutations of this perceived insult that they have received online. And it's like, well, that's the really stupid thing. Like, it's almost better to just go like, so's your mom, you know, because if you're taking time to really try to like to have a logical to quote win, end quote, an argument on the internet, which is like an impossibility. That's one of those Devil's Island punishments of like polishing, you know, the sterling silver outside where it tarnishes faster than it can be polished. You know, there is no winning of an argument on the internet ever in any way. And I would try to say, like, I'm like, dude, you can't win an argument on the internet, especially because like because even if you win, winning as it is understood in the real world is where you're in a room with somebody and you make a point and they finally say, I guess I can see what you're saying there. And, you know, and maybe other people say, well, I think, okay, I think we've all kind of, you know, we've all like learned something. And there's a public acknowledgement that one side has sort of been demonstrated as being the more rational or, you know, the more substantive take in the debate.
And that almost never happens on the internet. I mean, literally almost never.
I mean, because if you do that, the 99.999% of the time, the other person's just going to vanish and not respond.
Right. That's usually what winning means on the internet, is the other person just gives up and stops responding.
Right. And that's, you know, but you're never going to get the satisfaction of them going, well, I guess you're right. So there's that level of responding where you just, you really like go, you just go right back at it. And then there's the middle ground, which is, I think, what like Sarah does. And if somebody sends hate mail to Sarah, which does happen, you know, not nearly as much as, you know, as it did, I think, you know, I don't know, maybe 5, 6, 7, 8, 9 years ago. But she'll get, you know, snarky email occasionally. And her thing is to send, you know, put on the sunshine and just to send something back that is, you know, really cheerful, not disregarding their point, but just responding with a sort of like good natured shucks. What can you do? I'm just a girl trying to make her way in this crazy world. And then always a thanks for listening and a smiley face, which either I suspect angers the people on the other end, but in a way that they can't really respond to, which is great, or they will feel chastened and ashamed, and they'll respond and they'll apologize, or just, you know, whatever. And then there's my thing, which is, it sounds like it's you and I are sort of on the same page, where when I get hate mail at this point, like, to me, it's actually sort of gone full circle, and it's just awesome. Like, when I get – because it doesn't happen very often. Because, A, I don't really do the kind of show that I used to, you know, like 15 years ago, which is where it was like a very sort of like – you know, it was like an issue-oriented, like really like an argumentative, you know, kind of show. Like, I haven't, you know, talk radio sort of changed, and I don't really do that much anymore. But also just because at this point, like, even when we were on, like, you know, CBS or at 970, even when we were doing, like, terrestrial radio, if you were listening, you're like, if you were the kind of guy who was going to be really irritated by the show or you were going to hate me or something, you probably just had made the decision to move elsewhere with your radio yeah. choices. Like, you weren't listening to the show anymore.
Yeah, flat-out hate mail where somebody – it's rare. I don't get much anymore. But honestly, flat-out, like, hate mail when somebody is upset enough by something that you – because, you know, again, this show, your show, it's about pop culture.
Right.
When I was writing on the internet, I'm writing about movies. If somebody really cares that deeply to write, like, a viciously angry letter about something, they're just crazy.
Yeah.
That's it. They're just nuts. Because why else would you care that much about, like, Adam Sandler movies or, you know, or what have you? You know, or you say – you slagging on, like, you know – some Nirvana album or something. I mean, it's like, if people care that much, they're just nuts.
Did I ever show you that email that was from, and inexplicably, I think this one was from for Outlook Portland. It wasn't even for this show. And it was, I forget what the subject line even was, but it was like a subject line, and then it was a one sentence email, and it said, "If I ever see you in public, I'm going to punch you in the effing face." I think the subject line was like, "You are a goddamned moron" or something. And yeah, it was like, "If I ever see you in public, I am going to punch you in the effing face. F you, Emerson." And I actually was like, I spent all week. I'm like, "Hey, have you seen the greatest email that I got?" And it's like, I couldn't wait to, you know, to like, I would get into a conversation with somebody and I would take out my iPhone. And it was like 10 seconds. Like, "Look at this email I got." And it was the best thing. So I have, they have, it sort of has become a pleasure that I don't get very often anymore. So it warms the cockles of my heart when it does happen.
Yeah, I was trying to find this. I've got you get the customer reviews on iTunes.
Right, right.
And so for Ham Fisted Radio, we've got very high ratings. We've gotten a lot of ratings. Actually have a ridiculously high number of listeners, which always surprises me because I wonder, who are these people?
And what are these fools?
Why are they listening to Bobby and I talk about what it's like to be like sidekicks on radio shows? But I'm trying to find this. Out of all of the ratings that I've gotten, because, you know, granted, you know, podcasting, usually, you know, people subscribe because they already like you. So if they're going to, you know, leave a rating, it's because they like you. So it's like 5 stars. I love this. 5 stars. I have one negative review on iTunes where somebody left 1 star and wrote, "Like them, but then I hate them." And she wrote, "Just based on their Twilight review. And I get it, you don't like Twilight books, but don't speak for us Twilight fans. How about having varying opinions on your podcast? You're nice people, but you really need some diversity on this show. You make fun of Twilight, but this show sounds like a bunch of old people with sticks up your butt."
Awesome. See, that's sort of great. See, to me, that's if you can elicit that kind of responsibility, that is a win.
Yeah, I know.
I will walk through the rest of my day with the biggest smile pasted on my face, knowing that I have irritated that person. I mean, it just puts a song in my heart.
But I also like the fact that she still says, and I still like you,
yeah.
though. Even though you make me so angry because you don't like Twilight. But, you know, I kind of like you anyway.
It's good to be alive, Don. What were we doing just now?
Well, we got a snuff watch.
All right. We should do the snuff watch here. We'll do a few more. Oh, I got the top five coming up here in just a bit. It's the top five songs about drinking and so forth. Well, let's do that. Here is your snuff watch for Thursday on the Rick Emerson radio program. Don Taylor with your snuff watch.
David Nelson, who starred on his parents' popular television show The Adventures of Ozzie and Harriet, has died. A family spokesman said he was 74.
Is he the last person from the show?
Maybe. Yeah, I think he might be.
Because Rick Nelson was dead. Obviously, Ozzie and Harriet were both dead.
Yeah, the only person available to give a statement for the family, Gunnar Nelson.
Okay. Not even Matthew Nelson.
No. Nelson, who was battling complications of colon cancer, died Tuesday at his Los Angeles home. He was the last remaining member of the Nelson's TV family, which included actor/bandleader Ozzy, his singer wife Harriet Hilliard, and his teen idol brother Rick. The show originated on radio in 1952 as Here Come the Nelsons, then read for 320 episodes on TV from 1952 to 1966 as The Adventures of Ozzy and Harriet. David Nelson also directed and produced numerous episodes of the show throughout its run. Gunnar Nelson, son of Rick Nelson, issued a statement saying his uncle's death was a great loss to the Nelson family.
So because the Nelson twins, they were Rick's kids.
Yes.
All right. So 70, I cannot get over that. 74.
I know.
I know that chronologically, like if I think about it, it shouldn't surprise me, but it does. I guess because it's like I think about him on the show and then I don't think about him at all. So it's like he's either that, he either is like a void in my memory or he's young. But you just don't think about him living as a seven. You know what it is? It's not that you can't picture him being old and dead, and it's not that you can't picture him being young. It's like the intervening years.
Yeah.
Where he was just sort of off the cultural radar. Wow.
But, he did a lot of television. He did The Love Boat and High School USA, and he directed bunch of TV movies. And,
so he did other stuff in television afterward. It wasn't like he just did that show and then sat around in obscurity for, you know.
No, he actually did a little bit of acting, but he did a lot of directing in like the 70s and the early 80s.
Because you feel bad for those guys, because you always wonder if he felt like he got a raw deal because Rick Nelson was the one who got picked to be, you know, to be a teen idol, to be the young Elvis or whatever.
Yeah, but I don't know. He seemed more like the more grounded
he was
them.
The Sean to Rick's David Cassidy.
Exactly.
That's the, because we've talked about that before. There's David Cassidy, who obviously, you know, has the higher name recognition and, you know, and has it, you know, even now is successful too. You know, he has had a resurgence in his second act. But Sean Cassidy, who's become like kind of a player in terms of television, you know, and it's like if you had to pick to be either David Cassidy or Sean Cassidy, I would probably pick being David Cassidy at this point because he's successful and he's probably not as out and out famous, but he doesn't have all that baggage that comes with being Sean Cassidy or it comes with being David Cassidy right now. He doesn't have all the negatives.
Yeah, it would be better to be Sean Cassidy.
Yeah. I mean, it's I always like it when those guys who maybe are, you feel like they've sort of been passed over for the fame wagon, you know, the way the others have.
Yeah, I heard somebody, I don't know if it was Corton Fatboy or I heard somebody just last week making some crack about Sean Cassidy, and I just kind of felt like, you don't know what you're talking about.
Seriously.
He's a terrific producer, and he did, like, awesome TV shows, and anything Sean Cassidy produces, I will watch.
I'm a huge fan of that guy. You know what's weird is, like, when you think about, you know, my dad had Ricky Nelson's records, which, even as a kid, struck me as a little strange because they were so clearly marketed at girls. My dad had the one that was just called, it was just called Rick, and I'm pretty sure, I don't remember this, but I'm fairly certain that the album art was like a side shot of Ricky Nelson, and I don't think it was a pencil drawing. I think it was like a sort of black and white photograph. But I think the name of the album was just Rick, and I think it was written in lipstick. I think it was maybe not though. I think it was made to look though as though it had been written like a girl had taken her Rick Nelson poster and she had written his name on it in lipstick on the wall of her bedroom or something. And I remember looking at that and just thinking it was a little strange that my dad had that. But if you were, you know, but if you were lacking. I guess the thing there was that there was a void because Elvis wasn't around. I think that's when Elvis was in the military. And so lacking new Elvis records, they just decided, well, we'll just get this guy and he'll put out our new Elvis records.
And there were always teen idols just being cycled through all the time, too. He was actually pretty back in the day when I was a kid at little punk rock clubs and stuff like that. Matthew and Gunnar Nelson used to come out to the clubs to see bands play. And they were the nicest guys. And they had to put up with so much crap from punk rock kids like, it's Nelson. And they just let it roll right off them. They're like, hey, how you doing? Well, you know, they could have been really snotty bastards about it, I suppose. But no, they were just really, really nice guys.
Well, and that was, you know, and that probably comes from growing up. See, it's one thing if, like, you would just grow up and you're in a rich family or your dad is famous or something. And so you're like a spoiled rock star kid. You know, you're like the son of somebody. You know, you're like Tommy Lee's kids or whatever. And they could just be little bastards. But they came from an entertainment family. So it was like the third generation in, you know.
And they also seemed to really understand it was like there was a huge divide between what they were doing and the music they were making and them getting into magazines as Nelson and like who they actually were and the music they were actually really interested in, because they were coming out to see, like, you know, 45 Grave and, you know, Agent Orange and those kinds of bands. So
I should say, by the way, just to wrap all this up, I have actually been trying to find a reason. I guess I don't need a reason. I guess that's the whole point of us owning this whole thing, is that we don't really need a reason to do anything or anyone's, you know, we can just sort of do it. I had that song, that Love and Affection song by Nelson, going around in my head for like 3 months now. And I keep meaning to play it one of these days.
Now you have a reason.
That's a fine song. It really is. The Love and Affection is a fine pop recording by those guys. I don't want to say it's representative of my music taste as such, but there's nothing wrong with that. That is a fine piece of musical confection. And then I think they followed, the Nelson Twins, I think they formed like a country band or something a few years ago. They started putting out country records, which were apparently not that bad.
Yeah.
All right. Well, in any event, so David Nelson, dead, 74 years of age.
74.
All right. And he died of what? Is it cancer or something?
Yes, colon cancer.
So there you go. There's your Snuff Watch for Thursday right here on the Rick Emerson Radio program. It is the Rick Emerson Radio program. Here is Don Taylor.
If you go to thenelsonbrothers.com, they have a website and you can get like posters and merch of them from back in the day and stuff. But you know something? However old they are now, they actually look pretty good.
Well, they were, you could tell that they came from good stock, I think.
They are handsome grown-up men.
They were good-looking guys even then. And of course, they had the unfortunate thing of the blonde wigs. That was like their, but you know, everybody needs a gimmick. But you could tell they were legitimately good-looking guys. And they didn't, you know, the wig thing aside, it wasn't like they were buried underneath a ton of makeup like a lot of other guy bands from that era. And you could see that wasn't camera trickery.
They were pretty.
They were the son of a teen idol. Yeah, they were descended from, you know, from a TV family. So here's Don Taylor.
Speaking of famous families, Brandy Favre has found a way to avoid talking to the public about her brother's penis. She's been arrested as part of a meth lab bust in Mississippi.
The idea that you'd have to find a way to avoid talking to the press about your brother's penis is so, that's a problem that I hopefully will never have. You know, that's a, you know, God willing, I'll never have to make that choice.
I'm an only child. I will never have to talk about my brother's penis.
So weird.
The younger sibling of the maybe sort of possibly retired quarterback was one of five people rounded up inside a condominium where a cooking station was hidden. The suspects were taken to a local medical center for decontamination before being thrown in jail. Brandy has been charged with manufacturing methamphetamine and generating hazardous waste. Brandy Favre has run into legal trouble before. She's previously been arrested for shoplifting and unlawful use of a weapon.
Being charged with manufacturing hazardous waste is sort of, I mean, that's like a C. Montgomery Burns kind of crime. It doesn't really seem like just your average person is really going to be hit with that charge. I mean, it's almost impressive in a sort of supervillain kind of way.
And it probably carries much harsher penalties than manufacturing meth.
Oh yeah, no, I would imagine that's the well, because the thing about it is, like, meth itself is just like so bad for you, because it's just the waste from meth. I mean, it's not like I'm some environmental nutcase, but the waste from meth has got to be one of the worst things you could just dump somewhere, because it's like it is the distillation, literally the distillation of everything bad, like from underneath your sink, all just put into one tub and then dumped out by the side of the road.
One of the most fascinating people I've ever interviewed professionally was a woman who was one of the very first professional a fingerprint analyst, and also like the very first woman who was ever a fingerprint analyst. But also she herself was instrumental in inventing and creating for law enforcement protocols for how to deal with meth labs. That, you know, how exactly what kind of protection.
Because it was unprecedented,
right,
in terms of the danger it posed.
Yeah, and she was part of a team of just a couple of people that actually put together protocols for, like, nationwide for law enforcement of, like, you know, because you really, really need to have some lung protection,
yes,
say, before you enter the building. And that was fascinating. Just the idea that there had been no protocol, there were no rules what needed to be done. No one knew what needed to be done. But also there were no rules actually in place. And so there were cops that would just go in barefaced and barehanded.
I was going to ask if before that it seems like guys who would just go because they had no. How would you know? I mean, you wouldn't. You know, if you figure you've been busting guys who had like pot, you know, operations or something, there's no, it's not like you're going to come out of there, you know, like maimed or whatever. You're not going to be inhaling something dangerous probably. And so there was no reason to believe that it was going to pose a risk.
Yeah.
So there must have been just a rash of injuries and, you know, debilitating sort of conditions that people got afflicted on them because they went into those places. When I lived in that horrible apartment building that was right near the whatever it's called now, the Angel, the Swingers place. There would be on occasion, there would be, you know, they would come and they would bust somebody there for dealing. And once, though, while we lived there, there was, I don't know if it actually turned out that there was a meth lab, but you could tell that they thought there was a meth lab because we looked out our bedroom window across the swimming pool, which is sort of in the center of the building in the courtyard, to the other side where there were more apartments. And there was a guy, and they had the full on, like, from The Fugitive, like where it's like U.S. Marshal, like on the back of their jacket. And they had the battering ram thing in their hands that they swing and they break in the door. And here's how terrifying that was. It was actually so terrifying that as much as I wanted to see it happen in real life, I just shut the blinds and just went back inside. I'm like, I don't want to know what's going on over there. And then later I saw out front that they had like the hazmat van or something. And I think that might have been like the same week that we were like, we have got to move. Like this is – because, I mean, especially because like Jesus, I mean, you have no idea. Like literally the whole – if they were cooking some meth lab over there, the thing could have just exploded. I mean, the entire building could have caught fire. And I mean, that was where it transitioned from being like sort of grimly amusing to like, okay, we're leaving. Where you sort of recognize why the flight to the suburbs occasionally happens.
Oh yeah.
I mean, it's just, and plus, here's the thing about meth. This, I had never really thought about this until I had somebody who was a cop, and he put this in a perspective that I had never considered. This had eluded me. He said that if you think about meth as opposed to, you know, almost anything else, is that, that when you think about meth, meth is the first and I think only serious, hardcore, mainstream drug, and the first mainstream drug that you are just able to make yourself at home. It's like if you smoke a lot of pot, you know, unless you're some farmer, you live out in the boondocks, you got to buy that from somebody. You got to buy coke from somebody. You got to buy heroin from somebody. You know, most people can't make LSD because it's too hard, even if you're inclined to do it. It's like meth is the first and only mainstream drug that if you're an addict and if you consume it a lot, you also have the ability to go to Safeway and then go back home and make it in your house. And there's no other drug like that. And that's what makes it so dangerous, is that it is a thing that you not only is it easy to get and easy to make, you know, but it's also incredibly addictive. So then it's like everybody is not only a consumer, everybody is a manufacturer and a dealer if they want to be. And that was unprecedented. And that's one of the reasons why it was just so insanely dangerous, because you had guys who were addled out of their brain on cheap speed, then dealing with explosives and chemicals to make more of it.
Yeah.
And there was like no good outcome, because either they were successful, in which case they just had a whole lot more cheap speed to sell, or it was unsuccessful, in which case they were blowing themselves into kibbles and bits. So,
when I was working in Columbia County, because Columbia, at the newspaper, Columbia County has a huge, huge meth problem, because it's like the poorest county in all of Oregon. So you've got, you know, economic strife to begin with. And also it's very largely rural. There's massive amounts of just wooded areas where people can manufacture drugs, and there's nobody around to see them.
Right.
And Columbia County sheriffs, they're grossly underfunded when it comes to their drug enforcement thing. One of the things I had like this sort of deal I was working with the sheriffs, in that I would print their stories of their drug busts, and I didn't actually conflate the facts, but the thing is, we would never actually print that, you know, this was a drug bust that was basically carried off by two officers,
right?
Because that's all the guys they had.
Right.
He told me flat out off the record, it's like, you know, anytime you can print one of these stories and say that we did this, but just don't.
They want it to seem like it's overwhelming force.
We want them to think that we're everywhere.
Right. Right.
You know, and really, it was like five guys. But the thing is, on the one hand, you know, yeah, they were concerned about the public health aspect of it, that, you know, there's meth trickling down into like the high schools and that sort of thing. But really, I think the biggest concern was just not wanting hillbillies to blow crap up.
Right.
You know, the collateral damage of hillbillies blowing up their trailers.
And because if you're a guy who's cooking meth, then, I mean, the odds are, I don't know, probably 70% that you are also using it to some degree, if only to stay awake for the manufacturing process. And so you're going to be addled out of your brain and dealing with, and dealing with things that are just incredibly dangerous in terms of it's just.
Well, and then there's the residual crime that comes from the fact that you've got a bunch of people who now are on an incredibly addictive drug that screws with your head.
Right.
Because people who are addicted to meth, it really does make you paranoid and crazy. And then they need money. And they'll do like anything to get money to buy more of the drug that's making them sleep deprived and drug addled and crazy.
Lara had a friend whose husband eventually came out was a meth addict. He had a great little scam going. His whole thing was that he—and you really got to give it to him because, you know, junkies are motivated. He was a meth addict, and I forget exactly the timeline of events here, but his scam was that he actually operated—he had a home cleaning and maintenance service where they would come to your house and they would clean your house and they would—and he would also do, if you had, like, grease stains in your driveway or, you know, like, oil stains, like really hardcore cleaning and stuff that, you know, you just couldn't do yourself with a mop. But then they would also come through and they would do like an entire clean of the inside of your house. And it was basically a home janitorial service. But of course, the reason he was doing this is while he was in your home, he would just be underneath your sink taking all of your stuff that he could use to make meth. And then they would also daisy chain it so where he would take a bunch of stuff from one house. And then as they moved to the next home, another team of guys would just stay behind and they would just make the meth in your garage.
Oh, God.
And then they would pack, because the thing is, if they were going to be cleaning your home, they knew what hours you were going to be gone, because they'd say, well, look, we'll come and we'll clean while you're gone. So, you know, we're not in your way. But by the time you get home, your house will be spick and span and totally presentable. When are you going to be home? When are you usually home from work? I guess I go home around 6. OK, we'll be gone by 6. And sure enough, they were. Because at 5, they were packing the meth lab back into their truck and they were leaving. You know, it's really an unprecedented drug.
And the other thing about a place that where people are cooking meth is if they're doing it on a regular basis, it becomes a hazardous waste zone.
Right.
And so there were things in Columbia County, one of the stories I remember, and this is not an unusual situation, people got busted. They actually, it was a house where there was somebody living on one side and their like ex-boyfriend or brother or somebody was living on the other side of the house. And the fumes got so bad, they decided the non-meth person decided they had to figure out what's going on and realized that the ex-husband or brother or whatever was cooking meth over on the other side of the house, turned him into the cops. Thing is, it was a rental. It's like a very nice suburban house in a relatively nice suburban neighborhood in Scappoose that now this person can't rent, can't sell, is on the hook for like tens of thousands of dollars to clean it up so that it will pass, hazmat regulations. And now it's like, great, thank you. Awesome.
Thanks so much. I appreciate that. Thank you. You're a real pal. Good God almighty. It is the Rick Emerson Radio Program. It's 503-505-6964. Thank you for joining us. We'll get the top five. By the way, I have put the top five is in your Dropbox in there. So it's 503-505-6964. You can also – what was that evil cackle?
Thank you for putting your top five in my Dropbox.
Zam. Tomorrow we'll be joined by Mr. Big Jim Willig. He will be here for another installment of Humor Me Comedy 101, talking about the life and work of Ms. Margaret Cho. So that'll be tomorrow. And don't forget, he'll be at the Baghdad tomorrow with his performance. We'll have more details on that. Saturday, Aaron Geek in the City. Duran going to be unveiling his brand new comic, La Brujea, the first comic from Geek in the City. That'll be at the Bridge City Comics. That'll be Saturday, 6 to 9. That's 6 to 9. And then on Sunday. You should make a note to watch Outlook Portland. We'll be talking to Mr. Harold Phillips, who's a local actor and one of the guys who really works to keep Oregon's film incentives in place so that things like Leverage and you know the first Twilight movie, so they keep doing that stuff here. That's Outlook Portland this coming Sunday.
Basically, you should just plan your entire weekend around us.
That's right. Really, we're like the Mormon Church. We give you something to do every single day so that you never really have to think, you know, for yourself or decide, you know, on your own how to spend your time, really. We're just going to schedule every moment of your existence and your post-existence as well. Here is Don Taylor. We'll do like a couple more here, and then we'll do the top five.
Well, we've had this laying around for a while. We should do this. Michelle Williams and Ryan Gosling star as a couple whose marriage is in trouble in the...
This story's been here for like 10 days. I think, because yeah. I think Eric Snyder talked about it last week, and he never actually got to it.
Yeah. The Happy Go Lucky Good Time movie.
Have you seen it?
Feel good film, Blue Valentine. I have not seen it.
I don't even know that I want to see it. It actually looks, and this is strange for me, it actually looks so depressing that I might just avoid it. I don't know.
And that's what I've heard from people who I respect, that it's a very good film. And it's really, really depressing.
Yeah, it's because it's the, and apparently it is because it's about the slow dissolution of a marriage.
Yeah, and it's told in a non-linear way, so it goes backwards and forwards.
Right.
So basically, you are watching the end days of a marriage at the same time you're cutting back to the happier early days, but where you're seeing the little seeds that will eventually grow into dissatisfaction.
Well,
you know, the death of love.
It's like that. It's sort of a variation on that endless Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind thing, which is a great movie. But I mean, it's really just a ball punch. You know, if you see it on the wrong day, that's one of those. I mean, I love that movie, but that's one of those things where you watch it, you just kind of go, "Oh, it's so sweet. Oh, kill me." You know, and this apparently is. I mean, it's a great film from everything I have heard, but it's. I may wish to avoid it.
Well, it was given an NC-17 rating because there is an oral sex scene between Michelle Williams and Ryan Gosling. Executive producer Harvey Weinstein pointed out that the movie Black Swan got an R rating, despite the same acts being performed by two women. Now, again, I will say I haven't seen Blue Valentine. I will say that if you could have R-rated or even PG-rated oral sex, that would be what you saw in Black Swan. It was not graphic.
It's very tame.
In any way whatsoever. You basically saw, you know, Natalie Portman thrashing her head around, and then occasionally there would be a shot of like the top of, you know, Mila Kunis's head.
Well, which is not too far from removed what I think they did with between Tara and Willow on Buffy.
Yeah.
The first time I was wondering how they were going to handle that, and it was actually very. I mean, it was obvious what was happening, but they were very, very, very circumspect about it. So
other than the fact that it happened during a
such a retard, I go right to a Buffy the Vampire Slayer thing.
But there was a song though. That was what she was singing.
You make me complete.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. It was kind of tacky.
I was
really
going to mention that just now actually, and say that was a little bit
you
of.
You know, and the whole thing about spread beneath. Yeah. My willow tree or something.
That's the worst song. It's
it was
the
awful.
Worst song. I toyed with just now with whether to make that observation, and I didn't want to say it out loud because it's so tacky. It's not even that it's so badly done.
Yeah,
she says, you make me complete. And then she draws out the final one where she says, like, you make me come. And then there's the ellipsis.
Yeah.
Bleat.
Yeah.
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 The whole. Nah, never mind.
Anyway, so anyway, Harvey Weinstein complained about Black Swan. So now Blue Valentine has the R rating. Ryan Gosling says he never saw the sexual act as anything but a loving exchange between two consenting adults. And he was mystified by the original NC-17 rating.
There's no real answer. I'm told it's because of the oral sex scene in the film, but that's confusing because there's plenty of oral sex scenes in other movies, you know, where it's a man receiving it from a woman, you know, that are R-rated, and yet ours is reversed, and somehow it's perceived as pornographic. Or Black Swan has an oral sex scene between two women, and that's an R rating. But ours is between a husband and his wife, and that's NC-17. And, you know, then, of course, then you start to think, well, how is it possible that, you know, these, like, torture movies where you can torture women and in the sexual context, that's... can have an R rating.
Do these guys all get dosed with the same drug before they do these interviews? because it's like they're all being played in the wrong speed.
Well, it's also, you know, I think that also it's just a matter of these things are recorded during these junkets.
And they're exhausted because it's the 75th time they've answered the question.
Yeah, they've spent the entire day in a hotel room at the Four Seasons spending, you know, 20 minutes each with people who walk in and, yeah, and ask them the same six questions. And yeah, so it just never very few actors really seem to be able to do it. And Clooney is one of the few that I can think of. Is that every soundbite you ever hear from George Clooney, it's like it's the first time he's ever heard the question, and he's damn glad you asked it.
Well, George Clooney also has that. He has that weird charisma, that ability to make it seem like he's really just talking to you.
Tom Cruise has the same thing.
Oh yeah. Well, that's but that's because he's crazy. He's got that's really one of the reasons that Tom Cruise is so successful, because you know that it's a shuck, you know, that he's just turning it on, but it's completely convincing. I mean, he is a method actor. I mean, to the point of like acting as though he cares about the journalist who is talking to him, which he demonstrably does not, I think. The point that he's making here is actually really, I mean, you've undoubtedly seen this film is not yet rated documentary, mm-hmm. but the MPAA really is just so unbelievably, I mean, it's not even it's beyond even being like a moral hypocrisy to me. Just from a business point of view, it has got to be so frustrating to be the head of a studio or something and just never knowing if you're going to get screwed with an NC-17 rating. You have to go back and you have to pay every time you submit a new cut of the film.
Well, it's like being a bar owner here and dealing with the OLCC.
Right.
It's so arbitrary. It's really down to the day that someone looks at a movie or, shall we say, comes and inspects your bar.
Right.
And who the person was that did the inspecting and what kind of a mood they were in, you know, what the end result ends up being.
Well, the idea that, I mean, as much as I love this, the idea that the South Park movie got away with an R rating is just like mind-blowing. I mean, it's just, I have no idea to this day how they managed to get by with it without an NC-17.
Well, especially things like,
Penis in there.
There's a penis in there that is like not just a penis, but it's a photograph of a penis.
It's a real
pasted
penis.
In a real penis that they put in specifically because they thought it was going to get cut out.
Yeah.
Because it was one of the things they put in to give the ratings board something to slice.
It was a distraction. It was a diversion.
Yeah.
And then they left it in. So, I mean, it's just, you know, there's just no... And then I think it actually comes back twice in that scene. Where he goes, hey, Satan! You know, and it's like, there's the... And I remember my wife and I mean, I think probably everybody had this experience. You talk about movies that just, like, the first time you saw them, it just took your brain apart. I was talking to Snyder about I know I say this, it makes it sound like all the good conversation happened on that one day that you were gone. But, you know, he and I were talking about Reservoir Dogs and the first time you saw the ear-cutting scene. And then I mentioned the adrenaline scene in Pulp Fiction, where, like, I had no idea what to expect. And the first time I saw Pulp Fiction with an audience, it was like people just, they were climbing the friggin' walls. I mean, it was like that, it was so well done. The first time I saw the South Park movie, and they come out with the Uncle Effer, and I was like, what kind of film? Who are these people that have made this movie? And I just had no – I mean, even loving South Park, I had no way to prepare for what the South Park movie was going to be. And then when they get to the sequence where, as Dennis Miller put it, an angry crimson penis emerged. I think that was the point where my brain just detached, and I was just like, I could no longer fathom how this movie got released.
No, my husband and I went to see that movie, and Patrick and I sat down, and then a woman came in with like five little girls.
Oh, God. Really?
Five little girls, probably about 10 years old. And we, being, you know, watchers of the South Park, we said to each other at that point, what is she thinking?
Seriously.
And then the movie started.
It's a cartoon.
And we sat there. And unfortunately, it was a bit of a distraction from the movie because we'd be watching the movie and then we'd like look down into the fourth row or whatever and go, has she left yet? Have they left yet?
Did they stay?
Did they stay? They were there for the whole movie.
Wow.
She never got up and left.
That's amazing. I don't know how I feel about that. I really don't know. I'm so conflicted. I want to say bad parent, but on the other hand, I want to say like,
well, it's like Pulp Fiction.
For them.
The second time I saw Pulp Fiction, there was a man in line who had two little girls with him that were about 11 or 12 years old.
Wow.
And at this point in my life, I would probably just pull the guy aside and say, are you aware of the content of this movie? At the time, being young and snotty, I just stood there really passive aggressively and went, oh, that's a really good idea because you don't get to see enough people dying from heroin addiction when you're 11 years old otherwise. But the thing is, again, I think he was like a dad who like had the kids for like
the weekend.
Divorce weekend.
Yeah.
And
the kids weren't going to cramp his social style.
And he did not take them out during the movie, no matter what happened. happened. They sat there through the whole damn thing.
I have a friend of mine. Her dad took her to see Jaws when she was like, because he wanted to see it. It was the big movie. So he took her to see Jaws when she was, you know, like three or something. And she said that it's just like miraculous that she did not leave the theater like catatonic. Because that was at that point where like you can't really differentiate the real and the fake. Well, that's like Jason Crump, you know, well, with the kid being warped.
And Jaws is, if Jaws is a movie that if you haven't seen it in a while, you know, I just saw it again last year for the first time in years. It is a vicious movie.
It's terrifying.
That movie would be like a hard R today.
Oh, yeah. No, it's...
It is a violent, vicious movie.
And the on-screen violence, too.
Yes.
I mean, it's not like implied. The shark is implied. The violence is shown. I mean, there's the severed arm and the
that
severed leg
where,
and the
where
quince.
Robert Shaw slides down...
Into the shark.
Into the shark's mouth, and it starts just chomping him.
Yeah.
That is horrifying.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. It's, no, here's the thing. This is the Spielberg... I sometimes talk about Spielberg and why you shouldn't have kids because it makes you soft. Because the thing about Jaws, the one thing about that movie is – not the one, but one of the things I point to in that movie is an example of the Spielberg then and Spielberg now. If Spielberg made that movie now, it would be much different, especially because, you know, he never would kill that kid, the Kintner boy. He would never pull the trigger on that and have a child killed on screen. And you see the killing happen. He would never do that.
He wouldn't even have kids menaced in the way that they were, even the ones who didn't, that nothing came
and
of
you,
it.
And you know that he wouldn't do it because when he made Jurassic Park, the kids were never really in. I mean, there was that sequence in the kitchen with the velociraptors, but it was like, you know, but they were never really in that much danger. And then later on, he has the kids sitting in the tree being licked by a dinosaur and they're giggling, you know.
Yeah.
After having been chased by velociraptors, they're letting a dinosaur lick them and they're fine with it. It's awesome.
The thing about Jaws is also that it is horrifying to watch in a way that it's a suspense movie.
Yeah.
It's not a horror movie. That I can watch something like Piranha 3D and you giggle at how crazy and over the top the violence is. You know, Jaws is an example of a movie in which it is violence with actual emotional consequences.
Oh, yeah.
And that is just brutal.
Jaws is one of my favorite movies of all time. I saw it at the Laurelhurst. I saw it on the big screen for the first time about 2 years ago. The Laurelhurst they were doing a different decade every week. And they did a 60s thing. They did the birds. And then they did this, I think it was horror movies too, because they did the 50s. They did like, I don't know, something. It was like The Blob or The Fly or something. Then they did the birds. Then they did Jaws. Then they did, I think, Aliens, maybe. But they did Jaws, and so I'd never seen it on the big screen. And I had a friend of mine who had never seen it, period. Laura and I had this couple we knew, and the girl had never seen it, so we took her to see it. And that was actually one of the rare times in my life that I have silenced a guy in a theater, because the guy behind us was talking. And I was afraid he was going to give a spoiler or just be a distraction, and I actually went back and I said, I never do this, but please, would you just, you know, like, be quiet, because you're going to ruin. And I actually said, I think I'm trying to terrify my friend with this movie, and you're going to ruin it if you keep talking. Because it was so important that she experience it. Because that's a movie, it was amazing that she'd never seen it. And plus, just growing up in the culture, it's referenced so often. But as you just said, it's like if people haven't seen it in a long time or ever, the way it's referenced in the culture, or if you've seen, like, Jaws 3D and the actual Jaws, they are two different films altogether. The sequence in that film. There's a couple moments in that film that are just – I just get chills actually just thinking about it. But that sequence with the guys on the dock and the Christmas roast. It's my wife's holiday roast, and they throw it in, and then it's like – and you just see the thing in that movie that is just – that just Fs me every time I see it, every time, is when you watch Jaws and the shark grabs the roast and the chain and runs with it. The dock tears off and goes into the river, and the guys are plunged in and they're swimming back to the shore, and you see the dock stop and turn around.
Yeah.
And I mean, it's like that was where you just say to yourself, like, oh, this is so bad. No, 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 no. And you just and so you just, you know, you just like you just turn into Hudson from Aliens, you know. You just, everything has gone wrong. So
yeah, there is terror in that movie that most horror films can't achieve. When Roy Scheider and Dreyfus and Quint, and they're all on the boat and they're drinking and they're singing, and then there's that shot from, and you've just had that wonderful warm moment that is much needed of camaraderie, and you're feeling, you get to relax a little bit, you get to feel a little bit good about things, and then there's the shot outside the boat on the water, shot from the level of the top of the water, and then pop, you know, the floater thing
Yeah.
Just pops up.
And it's got the blinking light on it.
Yeah.
And it's just sort of, and then it starts slowly moving toward the boat.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's just like, and you just kind of go, ah, ah.
Yeah. It's just.
It's horrible.
We mentioned the other day.
I love that movie so much.
We were talking about, well, you know, there's a documentary coming out this year about it too called The Shark Is Still Working. It is supposedly the, because, you know, the DVD, the Jaws DVD sucks. It's in the sense that, like, Spielberg is such a miser with extras. He never puts any good extras on his stuff. But the Jaws DVD, which I've purchased three times now, I think, and that's going to be the end of it. I'm not going to buy it again until they put something, because there's never been a commentary, for one thing, and there's really never been a full documentary, even though it's one of the most beloved movies ever. So there's this documentary that supposedly comes out this year called The Shark Is Still Working, and it is an attempt to make the definitive end-all, be-all documentary about the making of Jaws. So that comes out this year. The Jaws, Terror, Shark, something, light, move. I had something I was going to say, and now it's just gone. Well, in any event, it really is just, that is a, if you haven't seen it in a long time, you owe it to yourself to see that movie, because it is just, it is so fantastic and so well done. And now I'm going to be thinking about that sequence of the light, like, blinking and heading toward the thing. It is the Rick Emerson Radio Program. Let's do one more, and then we'll do the top five for today.
Oh, okay. A Pennsylvania man arrested on an open warrant when he arrived to court for a child custody hearing was allegedly also carrying heroin and marijuana.
Excellent.
The incident happened Monday at the Allegheny Court courthouse when 33-year-old LeVar Bates arrived for a child custody hearing. Following routine procedure, deputies ran a check on Bates and found he was wanted on a bench warrant for harassment and terroristic threats stemming from a December 5th incident with his ex-girlfriend. Deputies immediately approached Bates and took him into custody without incident. When they searched him, they recovered two knotted baggies containing 92 stamp bags of heroin with names varying from Waka Flocka, Try Again, and Survivor.
Are these the various brands of heroin that he was selling?
I guess so.
Excellent.
They also located another three baggies of suspected marijuana.
Okay. So there you go. There's that guy. Should take a moment to talk about E.H. Vending. And I said that we were going to sort of talk about the name that snack contest. We're just talking about it in the sense that we have yet to figure out exactly how to revisit it. Because everybody did I ever tell you how I believe Adam Owen was his name? Aaron Owen, I'm sorry. Did I tell you how he guessed Funyuns?
No.
This is proof that God hates me. This is how my life works. So Corn Nuts, freaking listener Rick, you know, sat next to his sister-in-law and ate Corn Nuts for like 10 years. So that's how he knew the sound. The Fig Newtons thing. I have no idea how that ever happened. How the guy figured out Fig Newtons from like Sweet and Made by Nabisco. Bam.
Apparently, a lot of people just thought Nabisco Fig Newtons.
Who thinks?
I don't know.
Thinks of Fig Newtons?
I mentioned that to somebody like Cheryl or something. They went, well, you know, Fig Newtons is one of the first ones you think of. I was like, really? I didn't think anyone ever thought of Fig Newtons at all.
No. I mean, it's like, you know what Lara said to me the other day? You know, she hummed the Nabisco jingle, which I hadn't really thought of ever. Do you know the Nabisco jingle?
No.
It's the Nabisco. As soon as she started, I knew it, but I hadn't thought about it. So then, like, I don't know, maybe like on Friday or whatever, we do the, it comes in two flavors, made in the 60s. Listener Aaron Owen, who guessed that, I asked Cheryl, I'm like, how in the F did he guess Funyuns anyway? And she said, I swear to God, he just happened to be eating a bag of Funyuns while listening to the show, looked down and went, huh, maybe it's these, and then just like typed it and sent it to her. There you go. The end. I'm not bitter about it so much as I'm a little bitter about
it. This is the song I wanted to know what the name of it was.
Really?
Yes.
Here's the thing about that. Here's why that's unfortunate. Because as I load up the bank of sound clips for each day's show, all the Lenny D sound bites, I just have labeled them Live Read 1, Live Read 2, Live Read 3, Live Read 4. Okay. So the good news
is
I've found
it. This is the one
that
was stuck in my head for like a week and a half, and I didn't know what song it was.
Yeah, that's the... Somebody's typing. Don't tell her. No, I mean, it's here. It's been relabeled, so I don't know the name of it. Sorry about that. But now we have it. Anywho, well, this moment of frustration brought to you by E.H. Vending. You can find them at ehvending.com, or you can call Josh at 360-816-1853, 360-816-1853, or you can contact James, the sales manager, at 503-897-8204. If you're not happy with your current vendor, if you never really see them, then why stay with them? An alternative is talking to E.H. Vending, and You know, as Josh will tell you, if you talk to Josh, you talk to James, and if you actually have these companies that contract with you, you found this, that a lot of the times the problems aren't with the machines. The problems aren't with what's in the machines. The problem isn't that it's not taking a $1 bill, no matter how many times you rub it on the side or whatever. The problem is the actual vendor, because it's like anything else. It comes down to the people you're working with, and it comes down to the level of the customer service you're getting. So if you are somebody who is in charge of making decisions at your place of business, or it is if it's up to you to make these decisions to get these contracts with outside vendors and with the providers of your coffee service or your soda machine or a candy dispenser or the thing with the doors that has the sandwiches inside, whatever it is, if this is on you, you want to make sure that you get it done right and that you're not having to find a different vendor next month because the one you got isn't responding to your needs. If you are a small business or you find that with the recession you're scaling things down, and a lot of the big vending companies, they just don't want to, if you just got one store, if you got like one, garage, if you're a mechanic with one outlet, they don't want to know from you, as my grandfather would say. So EH Vending is not going to have that problem. You're going to find something that works for you. You're going to start off right the first time if you're opening a brand new business and get your vending machine needs taken care of correctly. So you're not going to have to, try to find some different company to deal with 6 months down the road. So you can call for appointments or service anytime. That's Josh at 360-816-1853. And it's Josh at 360-816-1853. Or you can contact James at 503-897-8204. And so 503-897-8204. You can also contact them at ehvending.com. That is Josh and James. And we should also note that in addition to being an advertising partner of ours and a business partner, they are also listeners and longtime listeners of that. And Josh has been listening for like 13 years. So they're just good folks like yourself. So you can contact them at ehvending.com. It is ehvending.com. All right, are we prepared for the top five?
Yes.
I'm sorry about the, I just don't even know what this is called. But see, here's the thing. But it's got this trademark Lenny D intro. But it's almost got a little bit of a, it's almost got, I imagine, what probably in the 50s and 60s seemed very Asian to them. Sort of an opening thing. So using that.
What's driving me crazy is I know I should know what this song is. Because I think it's a song that my mother used to sing, like when she was walking around the house, like cleaning and stuff.
It's not Little Brown Jug.
No, it's not. I know this song. And it's, oh, God.
Let me just do a quick survey of titles here. And we'll see if a title, like, leaps off the page from my Lenny D collection. Hold on a second.
If I used Shazam on that, do you think it would tell me something? Or
do you have Shazam?
No.
That was an awesome exchange right there. And a little mini Sorkin we just had there. I'm looking through to see if there's, like... My, if there's a song called, like, My Oriental Baby or something, like, from the... No, I'm sorry. I have failed you. Well, at least it's here.
Great, I can listen to it anytime without ever knowing what the name of it is.
Yeah, that's great. Well, here's what you should do, is you should actually, before tomorrow, you should get Shazam for tomorrow's show, and then we'll use that to figure it out.
Okay.
Let's do your top five. Here's the top five for Thursday
five,
on the Rick Emerson
four,
radio program.
3, 2, 1,
fail.
Counting is wonderful. Counting is marvelous. Counting's the best thing to do. Counting is happiness. Counting is ecstasy. I love to count, don't you?
All right, so because of the 92nd anniversary of the passage of the Volstead Act, Prohibition, we've gotten on a bit of a theme. I'll have Jim put this together for tomorrow, too, his top five songs about drinking. So we had yours yesterday. Now, on my list would have been One for My Baby, Frank Sinatra, but I have avoided that today because it was on your list. I have also avoided country songs, I have not avoided country songs as a whole as you did, but I wanted to make sure it wasn't an entire list of country.
And I will say, there will be one that we will discuss because... I thought about it and decided that it was not actually just like specifically about drinking, and so I didn't use it. So,
okay,
but we will chat.
So this is my attempt, and by the way, these are all subjective. So some lists I try to I try to make it representative of the general consensus, what the people themselves might say. Or, if we were going to present these to an alien civilization as the top five songs about imbibing. These, though, are very, this is not an objective list. This is just my own personal opinion. And also, I got to say, it's also the top five drinking songs as it seemed to me last night this morning. If you were to ask me next week, I might have a different take on this altogether. But as of now, these are what I would consider the top five drinking songs. Some of them, upbeat, some of them less so. But I've tried to be, I've tried to be sort of unbiased inside my own head about that. Don Taylor?
Honorable mention is Wasp.
Yeah, baby.
Blind in Texas.
That's how I roll. That's right. A little bit of, I've actually queued up the live version, too.
You have indeed.
Where you get to hear them shout, you get to hear them shout "Wasp." I feel like I should. I should probably put the other version on here instead.
So since not being a hard rock aficionado, since
yes.
"Wasp" is all capital letters, does it stand for something?
Oh God. Okay. Don't. Here's the thing. No one respond to her. Please, just do me a favor. Do me a favor. And,
I'm assuming it does not stand for white Anglo-Saxon Protestants.
Do not answer Dawn on that because, and I've been threatening this forever. I have said for a long time that I was going to do this, but I will tomorrow bring in, only because you are now officially asking for it. I'm bringing a copy of Bigger Than Jesus, which you have never seen, and which I would not give you. I can see you tensing up ever so slightly because it's when somebody's like asking you to look at something.
No, I asked you to give me a copy of it once, and you never did.
No. I'm just saying I would not blame you. I would not blame you if you had suppressed a groan just now. Because we've all look. Let's be honest. Yeah. We have all had this where someone says, "Hey, so my band recorded a record. If I give it to you, will you listen to it? Tell me what you think." And then you listen to it, being half afraid, but 90% convinced it's going to be bad. And you go, "Yeah, that's great, Bob. I'd love to listen to your band's record and tell you what I honestly think." And then you go home and you're like, "Christ." So Bob's going to make me. Or when you have to go see a guy's band perform, and you're like, "Bob, yeah. I have to go see Bob's band." And it's like, if they suck, I can't tell him. But if I say that they're good, he's going to invite me to see them again in the future. And I don't want to see them. I don't even want to see them now, but I promised him I would.
Or like when someone tells you they want you to read their poetry.
Yeah. And it's like there's no way to respond to that. It's like it is a no-win situation. I just because I've referenced it like a jillion times.
I do want to see it, though.
I'll bring it in tomorrow because I'll put it this way. Your question will be answered.
Okay. Thank you.
So anyway, so this is Wasp. This is from the Last Command record. If you all have seen Decline of Western Civilization Part 2, The Metal Years, the guy floating in the swimming pool drunk is Chris Holmes, who is the guitarist on this song and for this band. I'm a big Wasp fan. Not like at a huge, I've got everything they own kind of way, but they never really got their due. They were a band that kind of, they were never quite as successful as they should have been. So Blackie Lawless here, who is the, he's the lead singer and the sort of mastermind of the whole thing. So for a certain kind of 80s rock, this was about as good as it got. I mean, for a certain kind of very... It was either very raw, polished rock, or it was very polished metal. It was one of the two. But it straddled the line between a sort of glammy, high-sheen hair metal and a sort of more raw, stripped-down metal. And he was also an incredibly ambitious guy. Blackie Lawless was one of those guys who was determined to become a rock star, like, no matter what it took, and just did not care what he had to do to become famous. They were notorious.
I assume that Blackie Lawless was not his given name.
Probably not the child of Mr. and Mrs. Lawless, but one never knows. They became notorious for doing things like having nude women covered in fake blood on their shows on the strip. And one of their gimmicks, which, again, seems really corny now, but it was a simpler time. They had this whole thing where they would like throw like chunks of raw bloody meat into the audience because they would stop at a butcher's. They would be on their way to play at like the Cat House or something, and so they would stop at like an LA butcher store and they would get like a bunch of like just leftover like meat from the butcher, and then they would go on stage. You know, they'd be going to play at the, like they would be going to play at the Roxy or something, and they would just be throwing bloody raw meat into the audience, which in the era of Tipper Gore, that was an easy way to get people angry at you.
Yeah.
They also had a song which I believe was wrongly interpreted as being about bestiality, which was one of the songs that was used by Tipper Gore when they did the hearings, the PMRC hearings on Capitol Hill, which he loved because he had this whole thing that he was an Alice Cooper aficionado, and his whole thing was to become a notorious sort of villainous figure in rock. And anyway, so but the irony is that they just never really broke through the way that they should have, but created a very pleasing kind of rock in a specific sort of way. Great song.
I'm blind in Texas.
Texas.
Texas, baby. Texas. All right, these are the top five songs about drinking, in the opinion of me, Rick Emerson. Don Taylor, what might our next cut be?
Number five, George Thorogood, One Bourbon, One Scotch, One Beer.
So what you want? A one bourbon.
And now you'll have to point out when we get to the song that you consider putting on the list.
This song, I thought about putting this song on my list, and I think the reason I stopped was Patrick really hates the song, but the reason he hates it is he said that this was when he realized he had become an adult, is when he heard the song one day. He said, and all I could think was, oh, just go get a job, you loser.
Pay the rent, you dick.
Yeah.
Yeah. I have eschewed the whole beginning 5 minutes of the song, which is just a sort of spoken word thing we're talking about. And then I slip out the back door and I tell the landlady I have your rent next week or whatever, you know, and it's like the whole... And the landlord says, I don't pay that, no, never mind, long as you got my money on Thursday. And really, I mean, he obviously has a job in a band. It seems like even that's got to pay him something. Or he could live with the rest of the band in a truck.
I'm drinking bourbon. I'm drinking scotch.
I know this is a cover. This is a John Lee Hooker song, but I mean, really, this is the sort of thing you're not supposed to say. But this is better than the John Lee Hooker version.
I also didn't do this one just because it seemed too obvious. Just like for the same reason I didn't put Tub Thumpin'.
Yeah, I suppose.
Because it just seemed like, well, of course.
Being obvious and lowest common denominator has never been a problem for me.
It is a great song, though.
It really is. And the thing is, and I got to say this, that you know, that even as lame and as a teetotaler as I am, this is the sort of song where you realize, like, A, it makes you want to drink. Just hearing that, even me, I hear it, I'm like, I should go get ripped right now. I should go get wasted. And also you realize that if you were drunk, this would be awesome. If you were at a bar and this came on the jukebox, I mean, it's like if you ever go to, like, my father's place and a song like this comes on, and it's like you see everybody at the bar immediately kind of nod their heads and go, yeah. You know, because you realize, like, if you're on your way to becoming plastered, this is probably the best thing you've ever heard.
Of course, I don't really like scotch, so it always sounds to me like his order is displeasing to me.
So you would have scotch as the last one bourbon, one beer, one scotch.
I wouldn't have scotch at all.
But I mean, if you had to drink, but you'd go to that last.
Yeah.
Have you ever seen George Thorogood live?
No, never.
I got to tell you, and a lot of people don't like him. I know he's sort of a divisive figure, which it seems like who thinks that much about George Thorogood or like
who's, I like him.
Who's passionate about him? I know people who loathe George Thorogood, and I have said this for the longest time that to me, George Thorogood, he is the litmus test about irony. If you can just enjoy George Thorogood without having to snark or be smirky about it, or having to, or just having to like roll your eyes a little bit, if you can just enjoy George Thorogood for what it is, which is really basic, simple three chord rock, that to me is a dividing line about whether you can, you know, whether you can really just appreciate things for their own sake. It's sort of like a hipster tell almost. Anyway, but I've seen him live a couple of times, and I got to tell you, if you see George Thorogood, even now when he's like 60, if you see him on the right night in the right kind of venue, it's just one of the best rock shows you'll ever see. I saw him I was lucky enough to see him in a smallish sort of club some years ago, and he just tore the place into pieces. I mean, it was just really. And then I saw him at the Gorge, where he played his first couple of songs, and he said, you know, hello people, how you doing? And he said, is this town really called George? That's awesome! And then he just did like a fist in the air, like for no reason. You also got to admire him because he's had the same band, I think, for 40 years or something. And his drummer looks just like Bunny Carlos. It could be Bunny Carlos for all I know. But it's had the Delaware Destroyers have been the same band, I think, since 1968 or something. What do you want this time? I said, look, man. All right, these are the top five songs about drinking. Don Taylor, where are we?
Number four, Kiss, Cold Gin.
Now, I hope I've queued this up correctly so I can get the whole...
How you feel?
Yeah, baby.
All right, I got a little question for all you. I want to know how many people are here that can take a taste of alcohol?
Interestingly, this song is written by Ace Frehley because Paul doesn't drink. And Ace didn't sing at that point. Ace knew his gin.
I know, you know, it's getting so hot outside. You always need something to cool you off. There's got to be some people out there that like to drink tequila.
This is one of the all-time classic Kiss intros.
All right. somebody backstage before, and they would tell me there's a lot of you people there that like to drink vodka and orange juice.
So retarded.
When you're down in the dumps and you need something to bring you up, there's only one thing that's going to do it the way you want it.
What is that, Don?
What's that?
I'm assuming it must be cold gin.
Cold gin!
I have a friend of mine who grew up just worshiping Kiss, just a huge Kiss fan, and then we saw the reunion tour, and Paul did that rap, not word for word, but he kind of did a recreation of that rap, and it was like, it really, it was one of those moments where, like, I could see this weight come off of my friend Todd, and you could tell that he was one step closer to dying as a fully fulfilled man, seeing that whole thing done live. So there's Paul doing the rap, and I think actually Gene is the one who sings the song, because Ace Frehley, he would write, but he didn't. Ace had terrible stage fright, strangely enough, when it came to singing, and so he would just play and just. So that's Gene, and Ace didn't. He was too terrified to sing on the mic most of the time, and he got over that later on. But so he would write songs and just give them to Paul and Gene. And then here's Gene, who doesn't drink at all ever, and who in fact eventually kicked Ace and Peter out of the group for drinking. So that's sort of great. I like the idea that he's cocking, he's listing off this, he has this whole laundry list of things that are wrong with his life. Like, the heater's broke and I'm so tired. Because really, a bottle of gin is what you need to give you a lot of energy.
Yeah.
That'll pick you up. Awesome. These are the top five songs about drinking here on the Rick Emerson radio program. That is number four, Don Taylor.
Number three, Ozzy Osbourne, Suicide Solution. Now, this is the one I was thinking, because I don't... The song is about so much more than just drinking.
Well, it's about Bon Scott of AC/DC.
Yeah.
It's about drinking yourself to death.
Exactly.
Yeah. I mean, but... So to me, I mean, I guess you could argue that it's about more than that, but if you had to reduce it to one thing, I would say it is about drinking. That's always one of those things that angered... You know, like me and my sort of dirtbag metal friends, that was one of the things that pissed us off so much all through the 80s with the whole anti-metal crusade. And they would always, always pick this song about as being about suicide.
And it's not.
I mean, it's about, I guess in some philosophical sense it is, in the sense it's about drinking yourself to death. But it's about drinking, and specifically it is about Bon Scott. I mean, Ozzy has said that it's about, because this came out the year after Scott killed him, or after he choked on vomit, I think.
But essentially, it's a song about how you shouldn't.
Yeah,
you know.
It's an anti. Yeah, it's an anti-substance abuse song.
Right.
And Ozzy has cut several songs about drinking. He has a song called "Demon Alcohol" on the No Rest for the Wicked album. And he's written and sung extensively about substance abuse and, you know. This is one of those albums, I wish I could go back and listen to this album sort of fresh, because I've heard everything on this record so many billions of times by now, and especially working in rock radio where you just hear like Crazy Train like 10 times a day. I wish I could go back and hear like Crazy Train for the first time again, because I remember hearing the Blizzard of Oz album and just thinking it was just the greatest thing that I had ever heard. It's especially great when you consider that nobody expected Ozzy Osbourne to do anything once he left Black Sabbath. That everybody just figured he would just be found dead in a gutter 6 months later. Everybody placed their bets on Sabbath and not on Ozzy. They figured that Black Sabbath would continue on and that they would. He was the 30 Rock to Black Sabbath's Studio 60 on the Sunset Strip.
Yes.
Nobody figured that he would ever be able to achieve anything like his former success as a solo act.
So it's kind of interesting. You said the thing about hearing songs for the first time. I was watching the animated movie Megamind.
Yeah.
And it has a soundtrack by Hans Zimmer, but it also uses songs in a kind of a comic and very specific way, particularly when the wannabe evil guy Megamind is attacking things. And it's got like Highway to Hell,
right,
and George Thorogood's Bad to the Bone and Back in Black.
Yeah.
And all of which seemed really sort of cliched and hackneyed to me. But as I was watching the movie, I was thinking to myself, I wonder, you know, how many like children
are hearing this.
They might, or what, and hearing those songs for the very first time.
Going, this is awesome.
And then, you know, yeah, and then thinking, what is that song?
Right.
I want to know about this band. And then their parents having to say, well, honey, that's a band called AC/DC.
That's an interesting point, actually, because I, like Bad to the Bone specifically, I have gone on and on about how that is a song that is now only used ironically.
Right.
You know, and it's always used in kids. It's like Daddy Daycare, you know. And Highway to Hell is another one. But, you know, I hadn't really thought about the fact that that might be a kid's first introduction to AC/DC, which is sort of great. I mean, I could see that. Well, it's like Guitar Hero. That's why, you know, I have no, and I don't know why anybody would have a problem with Guitar Hero. I know guys who get all, Timmy Ryan, who get all pissed off about Guitar Hero. But if nothing else, I like, and it's not like music from my generation is better than music now or anything. It's just that, like, there's so much music out there, it's like you can't expect anybody to get an introduction to the whole swath of it. So I like the idea that at least there is a way that they're hearing a different kind of style or style or era of music. Not that it's better as such, but again, it's like the idea of just being exposed to as much as possible.
Yeah, like there's a segment in there, there's some set piece where I can't remember if it's a battle scene or if it's when they're just sort of laying waste to the city and destroying things gleefully in a humorous manner. But Welcome to the Jungle is playing. And it seemed kind of just sort of silly and obvious and dumb to me. But then I thought, but you know something, if I was 9 or 10 years old, and this might be like the first time I ever really heard that song and paid attention to it, it might be kind of awesome that you're actually, it is a little bit subversive.
I was just going to say, in just a tiny little way, it's a little subversive. I mean, I can get with that. I can see why that is the case. I mean, I'm enough of a sort of, you know, like sort of, you know, true believer with that stuff that I can be sort of pedantic about those things. Like I have real mixed feelings with it for that rock and roll camp for girls thing and the rock and roll camp or the rock school stuff in general, the whole like, you know, like they have the, I think there's actually a School of Rock franchise that opened here last year. And I have very, very mixed feelings about parents sending their, you know, suburban parents sending their kids off to rock camp for the summer, because it seems like that then just that denies them the ability to discover music later as a form of self-identification and something that they have found that speaks to them.
And I think there is, and I will say, I think there is a big difference between these like School of Rock franchises and rock camp and the rock and roll camp for girls, which is like a once a year thing and is specifically for girls, which is kind of awesome, I think, in its way. But yeah, the actual, it's like, honestly, rock and roll camp for kids sounds an awful lot like fantasy soccer camp or something for grown-ups.
It's just, to me, my whole thing about the rock and roll camp for girls, it's not, I have no problem with there being like a thing for girls. That to me is not, that's the first one that came to mind. It's just, to me, that is representative of the rock camp for kids thing, which I dislike because, to me, first of all, that's more
You're institutionalizing something that is supposed to be something that you discover as something that is an outlet against institutionalized life.
Because, you know, adolescence is the time where you separate from your parents attitudinally and philosophically in the way that you know, you start choosing things for yourself, and it is your way to slowly detach from the umbilical of your parents. But this, of course, is just another way, you know, to tether children to their parents and their parents' sensibilities. And also, let's be honest, it's almost more for the parents than for the kids, because it's a way
to rebel, honey, but we want you to do it in a safe environment where we know you're okay and doing things we approve of.
That, and not only that, but it's another way for parents to show that, like, I'm the cool mom. Yeah. No one likes anybody. If you're trying to be the cool parent, you are by definition not the cool parent. And, you know, and so, I mean, I think you and I and a lot of people have this story of like discovering or hearing a record for the first time that was not new to anybody else, but it was the first time like you had heard it. And so the first time you heard the Ramones or the Sex Pistols or AC/DC or Black Sabbath or Elvis Costello and you went, my God, what is this, this thing that has been sent to me to save me from this unholy hell of my, you know, and it's like, and you were just denied that if like 5 years earlier, you know, you and a bunch of like, you know, a bunch of other spongy kids from Lake Oswego were on stage playing Smoke on the Water so your parents could take photographs and put them on Facebook.
Well, to me, it's just sort of institutionalizing what should be rebellion.
Yeah.
It's like asking your kids if they would like for you to, like, fund their trip to goth camp.
Yeah, exactly.
Would you like to go to goth camp? I'll pay for it, honey. It'll be great.
Exactly. Or, yeah, or if, like, your parents are going to chauffeur you to the place where you lose your virginity.
Yes.
It just seems like it's not really the... All right. Well, in any event, these are the top five songs about drinking. Don Taylor?
Number two, Clint Black, Killin' Time.
This is the... I got to tell you, I love this song. And it's great because this was a time when country... I'll actually stop for just 1 second because there's almost no intro. This is a great thing because this is when country was – this is like the post-Garth era and country was exploding into the mainstream and everything was becoming very, very, you know – it was becoming very pop and very crossover, and I don't have a problem with that. But everything was become very, like, well-scrubbed and cheerful in country. And this is a great song because it's just such a relentless downer. And it was a huge hit. And the entire song is about a guy who has decided. He has made the conscious decision to drink until he dies. And I loved the fact that that was, like, right there between, like, Garth Brooks and Shania Twain on the charts. And it's just and I'm kind of a Clint Black fan, so, yeah. And in that way, it is really a great throwback to some of the classic country compositions.
You were the first thing that I thought of when I thought I drank you off my mind. When I get lost in the liquor, you're the only one I find. If I did the things I ought to, you still would not be mine. So I keep a tight grip on the bottle. Getting loose and killing time. This killing time is killing me. Drinking myself blind, thinking I won't see that if I cross.
It's like that thing that only Nashville really does well, where these jangly little, you know, confection-sounding pop hooks over just the bleakest, most unimaginably depressing lyrics ever.
Well, and also just one thing I think about when I hear really good country music, because I don't like most Nashville, you know, country music, but one thing that it seems that pop and rock, most producers don't really seem to embrace is any kind of texture in instrumentation.
Right.
You know, there's this, I mean, you can argue that, yes, this is the same thing. You've got, you know, the steel guitar, you've got the fiddles, you've got whatever.
Right.
But there are layers of complexity to, like, the Nashville production style that most pop records just don't bother to try and achieve.
Yeah, and they don't. Well, and country has never been shy about appropriating styles. Country, actually, strangely, country and rap have a lot of similarities that way, that if they hear something that works, they'll just go ahead and incorporate it in, which is why you end up with songs that have... Because for a long time, you were not allowed to have drums in country music. Drums were considered to be... They were D-class A. They were a thing that was... Purists really disliked having drum setups in country songs. But now... You know, but that was a wall that got removed. And if you hear country songs now, you'll hear songs that have a fiddle and a piano and a dobro and a mandolin and female backing vocals and a gospel hand clap section and a steel guitar and an electric guitar and an acoustic guitar. And it all goes together. And there's just no... And rock, for example, like...
And you listen to rock and every once in a while you go, oh, look, horns. That's fresh.
Right, because rock fans are just so relentlessly dogmatic sometimes about what they will and will not accept. Chuck Klosterman has written extensively about how in the 80s you were somehow not allowed to have keyboards in your metal for, like, reasons that no one could really explain or remember now. Punk fans are especially crazed about that, you know, where it's like, well, we're going to have a solo. Sell out! you know, and it, you know, and he's going to go, I'm sorry. Okay. You know, and, but yeah, country, they just don't care. They just, which is why you get things like, it's why you get things like Taylor Swift, who eventually leave the country classification altogether and just straight ahead pop, because they just don't make those weird. Yeah. For such a music that is so traditional in terms of the way it's presented and marketed. Yeah. The actual instrumentation is just, yeah, they kind of do whatever gets the job done. These are the top five songs about drinking. Number one, Don Taylor.
Number one is AC/DC, Have a Drink on Me.
This is my favorite AC/DC song of all time, by the way. This is such a fantastic song. And there is, you have to admire the chutzpah for putting this out as the first, you know, this is on the first record they do with the new guy after the old guy choked on his own vomit after drinking all night. I mean, there's something there, you know, just in terms of having stones. Make this observation every time we play something from this album, but this is 31 years old.
Oh God!
I mean, which A, we're all old, but also you think about all of the things that have come out between 1980 and 2011, and how dated and terrible and trapped in an era many of them sound.
Yeah.
You know, like we had that that song when Ryan White was here. That was the Kylie Minogue song or whatever. You know, so many things from the 80s especially, just, they sound so lost and so completely trapped in this weird, like, hermetically sealed museum of that time. And then if you listen to this, which is just, I mean, you know, it sounds so fresh and just so, it has so much vitality to it, even now 3 decades later. It is also, I think, a testament to AC/DC and how great they are, in that as much as people make fun of them for putting out, you know, the same song over and over again, or the same record over and over again, it seems like if that were really, you know, if the way that people knock AC/DC, if any of that stuff is true, it seems like anybody would be able to create a record just like this. I mean, if it was really just as simple and basic and repetitive as people seem to think it is, anybody could just write Back in Black. But really, nobody can. That's the reason we, you know, that's the reason we seize on this album, is because not everybody can do this. Great little mid-song change-up they do here. So this happens at the 151 mark, by the way, if you're playing along at home. Yeah, I could listen to this all day. All right. It's 4:30. God damn, we've been here all day.
Yep.
I don't even know what tone of voice that is. Glad, sad, happy, yeah. Indifferent. I just don't know.
I like my life. I like that this is how I spend my day.
All right, then. Let's see. Don't forget, joining us tomorrow will be Mr. Big Jim Willig with another installment of Humor Me. Don't know what happened there. Wait. All right. Big Jim Willig in the studio tomorrow for another installment of Humor Me, Comedy 101, with Margaret Cho as the subject. And we'll also talk about his show, which is going to be happening at the Baghdad. And then you'll hear us, gibber ourselves into a frenzy about being in the proximity of Ben Bailey from Cash Cab. We'll be on funemploymentradio.com tomorrow, so you'll be listening for that. Let's see. The Rick Emerson Show comes to you live each and every weekday from the studios of the Emerson News Network, high above the milk packing district here in glorious southeast Portland, Oregon. The news desk, Don Taylor, Advanced Technology and Magic, provided by Mr. Thomas Kill. Executive producer, Bruce Agler, Chief of Staff, Cheryl Kanakoa, who will be surprised, by the way, and glad that we went the last 90 minutes without talking about porn or dead people, really. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, much. Despite the first half of the show. So, well done, us. And this is all true. Thank you for joining us. We will have a brief musical interlude, followed by an encore of the day's Legion of News episode, followed by an encore of this very fine radio program, The Rick Emerson Show, made possible by a generous grant from you. It is Thursday, January 13th, 2011, and that is The Frequency, Kenneth. As always, thank you for listening. Be safe. See you tomorrow. Bye now.
You're listening to the Emerson News Network.
And the shadows be your guide. The best way out.